The End of Eternity. 1. The section of eternity given over to the 575th century is matter-oriented. The energy vortices of the 300s are gone. The field dynamics of the 600s have not yet come. In all the 20 millennial range from the former to the latter, matter is used for everything from walls to frying pans. Nor have all the recorded changes in reality affected that. On the whole, in all eternity, energy orientation has always been the exception. That is not to say that Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, 28th century, born in another matter-oriented time, felt himself at home when he moved into the anteroom that stretched out to a transparent door, and then back and back indefinitely through all of the 575th. After all, there are fashions in matter, too. To an energetic, matter tends to be matter, nothing more. All of it is gross, heavy, and barbarous. To a matrix, however, there is wood, metal, subdivisions, heavy and light, plastic, silicates, concrete, and leather in innumerable varieties and combinations. To Cooper, whose notion of a world was built about structures of light metal alloys, the sight of an ocean of glass and porcelain wherever he looked, the more impressive because there was no sight at the moment of anything human, had him open-mouthed. He stayed so until a harsh voice, heavy with 40 millennial accent, said, "Check in, damn you." Cooper blinked. "Sorry, sir, but I don't think..." In his confusion, he used his own 28th century dialect. The cragginess of the other's expression softened at the sound of it, and the aquiline nose beneath heavy, grizzled eyebrows grew somehow less formidable. The door behind him, through which he had entered, still swung its heavy glass softly upon one lengthwise field hinge, a concession to energetics not uncommon in a matter-oriented time. He reached out a large hand to steady the door and said, "Sorry, son. I thought you were a local out of time."
"No, sir," said Cooper, with an attempt at crispness. "I'm B.S. Cooper, 28th. My credentials."
He had shifted now to the 60 millennial tongue he had been practicing for days. He passed the personal capsule to the other, who did not look at the exposed flimsy, but put it to one side and laughed.
"My apologies," he said. "We're expecting a local man to take over the reception desk, and I jumped at conclusions. We're having trouble finding a new man, and we were through with the old one just a little sooner than we expected. You know how it is."
He said it with a blasé ease that Cooper tried to imitate in his nod. After all, the local people were experimental and observational subjects in addition to whatever jobs they held. He would have to get used to that. The other talked on.
"You always have to keep an eye on the locals. They never really understand about eternity. Never get it through their heads that you can't treat time like a football. They loaf around seconds at a time before checking in. If they have to check out, they do so, then go to the washroom on this side of the curtain. When they get back into time, they find themselves on the wrong side of a 2-minute hole, and there's hell to pay for it from the computers. When are you from?"
28.
Then, eagerly, "You from anywhere around then?"
"I'm 413th. What's your business here, son?"
Cooper's face lengthened. He might have been able to guess the man's time by his accent, but where is the eternal who, on first assignment to a new sector of eternity, can resist calling out, "Anyone here from the old 123rd? Or whenever his home time is. Or if he is too young and timid, or too old and dignified to call it aloud, he can at least think it. There is something about sharing a common set of social tropisms and prejudices that not all the washing and training of cub school can quite remove. And the most unpalatable person, if he is dressed in a costume you recognize as the right costume, the one that deep in your heart you will cherish all your life as the only right costume, becomes a prince and a companion to be cherished." But 413 was only a number to Cooper. At the moment, he could remember nothing more in connection with it than that it was part of a millennium marked by underpopulation and that it exported seedling trees to the various deforested centuries. It did so in fair quantities, too, since seedlings weren't as sensitive with respect to reality as were antiviral serums, human embryos, or vortex relays. Cooper said, "I'm to see Laban Twistle." He couldn't help raising his voice a bit as he said that. The other's eyebrows lifted, and he picked up the personal capsule he had disregarded and now looked at it searchingly.
Senior computer twistle?
That's right.
Well, take a seat, Cooper, and I'll get in touch with him. My name is Nero Attrell, by the way.
The earlier touch of condescension was gone from his voice. Cooper sat down, and his lips all but quivered with suppressed delight. He was here on Senior Computer Laban Twistle's request, and Twistle was a member of the Alwyn Council, and was considered throughout eternity as the greatest computer of them all. And it was Twistle who had asked that Cooper be assigned to him. He had not given any reasons for it, and yet Cooper was convinced he knew the reason. He had told no one of his conviction, not even General Manfield, his instructor, and the man whom above all in his short life so far he respected. After all, it had become obvious to himself for a long time now that he was being groomed for a special mission. He had caught his first glimpse of what that mission must be more than a physio year ago. One had to learn, almost at the beginning of one's schooling, the difference between years, which did not exist in eternity, and physio years, which were merely the measure of the aging of the human body. It had come about in this way. There were 5 cubs in the 28th century class, 2 from the second decade and 1 each from the 5th, 7th, and 9th decades. He had himself been the 9th decade student, having been born in 2784 and taken into school in 2798. If he had stayed in time, he would be 29th century now by 7 years. But they always counted century from the moment you left time and entered training. He'd be 28th to the day he died. In his mind, he changed the phrase to, till I die. What was the use of speaking of days in eternity? Though, of course, everyone did it. They said yesterday and maybe next year, just as though it meant something. But of the 5 cubs, he alone specialized. He was hastened through computer mathematics as fast as he could be driven, and except for that, all effort else was devoted to primitive history. He complained once. The others, he pointed out, were receiving well-rounded courses. Instructor Manfield had rubbed his brown hair into a mat of confusion and had said, "It's direct orders from the council, son." People always had a tendency to call Cooper son, perhaps because his light hair and eyes and his small-chinned face made him look conspicuously younger than his years. I don't know why. There was nothing for it but to go back to their browsing over old periodicals, print on paper from the days before film grew fashionable, until lives and deeds and names long dead were living things to both of them. A physio year before, he had read one of Computer Twistle's research papers as an exercise in mathematics. Analyze Twistle's results in terms of temporal tensors. And that led him through an independent search into other papers by Twistle. And from that, he was led into certain byways of speculation concerning which he dared not speak even to Manfield. But he thought he knew then what was happening to him and why, and he waited, more or less impatiently, for the call from Twistle. It had come. Just before he left, he had one last talk with Manfield, and he had been unable to forbear hinting. Surely Manfield must know of this, and Cooper wanted corroboration of his thoughts. He wanted it badly. "What would he be wanting me for, sir?" he asked. "I've been specializing in primitive history."
"I know, I know." Manfield smiled at him. "I'm afraid that in the years we've spent on it, I've grown over-interested. I'll probably be continuing in the field by myself after you're gone."
Cooper knew what he meant. The news magazines of the primitive centuries, with their chronicles of uncontrolled blood, crime, and passion, stamped indelibly into a reality that could not be altered, made fascinating reading. He would miss the hours he and Manfield had spent on them together. Cooper edged a little closer to what he was sure was the truth. "But I want to work on the primitive centuries. I want to do original research on them. Working in the 500s would not be exactly what I wanted." Now, if Manfield knew, surely he could not resist hinting just a little. But either Manfield did not know, or he was too wise to fall into traps, or else, and this Cooper bitterly rejected, Cooper's speculations were all wrong. Manfield said, "There will always be spare time in which you can engage in a hobby, son." He smiled again, but even his smile seemed to have an edge of sorrow behind him. His students, who uniformly loved him, knew nothing of his past. He never spoke of it, even to Cooper, who had spent the most time with him. Somehow the knowledge that he was born in the forward millennia, the upwinds, as the common phrase had it, had percolated down to the students, and they accepted that without too keen a search for evidence. It was said that he had been a computer once, an outstanding mathematician, a good prospect for the Allwind Council, and that he had thrown it all over to become an instructor of cubs in the far downwind centuries. "How do you feel?" asked Manfield. "A little scared, a little excited," said Cooper truthfully. "I've never been anywhere, you know, except for that field trip to the 40th, and that was only a 2-day report on municipal life under decentralized conditions." What he did not add was that it was only by dint of much begging that he had been allowed to go, although it was basic stuff for the rest of the class. And the next morning, Brinsley, Sheridan, Cooper had taken a small one-man kettle and passed, alone, through the corridors of eternity. The kettle didn't pass through space in the usual sense of the word, and of course it didn't pass through time, since eternity short-circuited all of time from the 28th century, the first century of eternity, a fact that was the 28th's greatest and proudest claim to fame, to the unplumbable entropy death ahead. But Father Time. The kettle went through or over or along something. Cooper was still untrained enough, still young enough, to wonder what that something was. His wondering didn't help him. Whatever it was, it remained unknown to him. But it passed, and then there was a neat little sign that said 575th in the local numeration system, as well as an atemporal standard. There was even an atemporal standard tongue that somehow rarely got used outside official reports. Local dialects were more satisfying, it seemed, and Manfield used to explain that by calling it an unconscious expression of the return-to-time drive. In a few moments now, Cooper would actually meet Twissell. Twissell, the oldest living senior computer, the man who had authorized more quantum changes in reality than any senior computer who had ever lived, the man who was the greatest authority on Harvey Mallin, the 24th century primitive who had made eternity possible. It was Harvey Mallin who was the key to his own. The voice of Atrell broke into his reveries. "Senior computer Twissell will be ready for you soon, son." "Thank you, sir." Cooper was never offended by the word son. If he and Atrell existed in time, he would be some 40,000 years Atrell senior. He might be Atrell's great-great-great-many-times-great-grandfather. But this wasn't time. This was eternity. Here, the word son meant nothing. Really nothing, since no eternal might even have a son. All eternals must be born in time of timed parents. Only in that way could it remain certain that eternals would retain the spiritual connection with mankind that was so necessary for their work. Let eternals have children of their own, eternal from birth, and dynasties would be formed, divorced from earth. From the wise directors and molders of humanity, the eternals would become its tyrants. Cooper was still young enough, still school fresh enough, to feel no pang of self-consciousness at being idealistic. Atrell said, "Would you like to look over the century while you're waiting?" "Yes," said Cooper, suddenly grinning. "Can that be arranged?" "No trouble. They've got a trick view scope here, Wend. They use it clear into the 600s, and then they switch to field focus. There's one in the next lab that I can hook up for you."
"Well, thanks."
2. Nero Atrell cast a cautious glance at the youngster at his side. He had been 20 physio years an eternal, and he was not given to pampering cubs who swam in on their first missions through seas of world saviorism. But this one, somehow, must be different. Twissell had sent for him. Now, Twissell was a hard man to know, but Nero Atrell had known the old gentleman for a sufficient percentage of his own lifetime to know when the man was excited. And Twissell was excited. He had twittered softly into Atrell's ear over the communo only a moment ago. "Yes, I have been expecting the young man. I will be ready soon. I will rush. It is only a quantum change I must make sure of first." The excitement was obvious. It lay in the word, rush. Twissell never rushed for others. He had once made a committee of the Allwind Council wait 5 hours, and had never bothered to explain. But now he was going to rush for a thin, pale cub who was overwhelmed at finding himself in an other wind so long from home. The whole thing invested this newcomer, Cooper, with a strange interest. and Attrell found himself nursing the beginnings of friendship for the boy. It did not take Attrell long to hook up the viewscope. The 575th was neat and logical in its technics. The scope seemed just a glass-topped table, but then suddenly the glass was not there, and a city was, looking like an excellent photograph in tridimensional color. Attrell smiled slowly when a small exclamation forced itself out of Cooper. He had expected it. It always came when an unwary spectator first noticed that there was motion within the photograph. The cub leaned over the scope, trying to crowd it all into his eyes. Then he stepped away, frowning.
"If you want a closer view," said Attrell, "I'll show you how the controls work. They're quite simple."
The cub shook his head. "It's all right. It isn't so different, is it? Somehow I thought it would be different."
"Different from when?"
From the 28th. From home, you know."
"Should it be?"
"Well, it's 50,000 years in the future. 50,000 years upwind."
Attrell smiled tolerantly. "You know," he said, "I don't think there's a cub ever invented who hasn't had the same feeling when he first looked over the time he was first assigned to. Things are never any different somehow."
"You don't really mean that, do you, Mr. Attrell?"
"Well, I'm exaggerating a little, maybe. Look, do you mind if I explain something to you?"
"I'd appreciate it, Mr. Attrell."
"Well," thought Attrell, "he's polite." Attrell had been told often enough, once even by Twistle, that he was a man from the underpopulated centuries, and that therefore he was bound to be unhappy in the company of strangers. That might be, yet he felt himself warming to the kid.
He said gently,
"All right, then. This is what I want to explain. You're going to find out the human pattern of history isn't a line. It's an irregular sine curve. Progress doesn't continue in a single curve so that all times are different from yours. A given era is just as likely to be similar to your own as different."
"I've been taught that."
"You've been taught that, yes. But a fellow from the 28th never really believes it till he sees it. Don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against the 28th, but you've got to admit that the 28th is only the first full century of eternity, right?"
"True enough."
"And the 28th is always very conscious of primitive times, the centuries before eternity begins."
"Yes. Primitive history is my field of specialization, in fact."
"Then there you are. The last millennium of primitive times was a kind of straight-line development with a steadily developing technology. Naturally, you get into the habit of thinking that such a straight line will continue. I don't have to tell a major in primitive history that sometimes the human race doesn't progress, if such a word has meaning. Sometimes it retrogresses."
"It's true," said Cooper, with a prim pursing of his lips, "that for a millennium after the first century there was technological decline, and no real recovery of the standards of the half millennium before the first century till—"
Attrell, who had been listening to the faintly pompous manner in which Cooper was trotting out his new-painted knowledge, suffered a sudden spasm of suspicion. Was he the one being made sport of? He said, "The half-millennium before the first century?"
"Yes, honestly. The first century wasn't the first."
"They just call it the first century for no reason?"
"It's a little complicated. Look, it's like this."
"Well, never mind."
Attrell decided that the boy was serious, and he felt no desire to go into the paradoxes of time. He said,
"It's your specialty, so I'll take your word for it. I majored in life plots myself. The point I'm trying to make is this. People go in circles. They may be far upwind or downwind and still be a lot like you. Or they might be just nextwind and quite different. Don't let the differentness get you either. What may look like decadence or barbarity to you may be a finding of new and better values to other people. Are you acquainted with the 413th? Against his will, Attrell found a defensiveness, almost a belligerence, rising in him at the thought of his home win. Cooper shook his head.
"Not in any detail."
"We've only got 100 million people in it. It's a good time."
Suddenly he was drenched in homesickness. It had been a long time since he had visited the 410s and 20s. He could smell the cold, piney air and see the blue of the glaciers against the horizon. He could almost feel the clear space, the openness of the world. Gloomily, he said,
"I guess your 28th is crowded up."
"Quite a bit. 5 billion.
"So's this 575th. So's almost every win. In my time, there was a small glacial period, you know. The forests took over. The cities broke up into smaller, friendlier aggregations. We like it, you know. But every time there's a quantum change, the underpopulated eras squeeze in. That's what the Alwyn Council calls them, the underpopulated eras. In the other glacial eras, they use underground cities, or develop solar energy. Most of them keep the population high. Now, I think underpopulation is fine. I don't consider it underpopulation. I consider it sensible population. People from most Wen are horrified. So there you are."
Atrell was getting emotional, and of course, as he felt that, he bit his lips together, and there was a sudden silence that lasted uncomfortably. Finally, Cooper said, "When did Computer Twistle say he'd see me?"
"You can't tell about Twistle," said Atrell.
Then, unable to resist the urge, he asked,
"I suppose you're on the Harvey Mallon project."
It amused Atrell to see the alarm spring into the youngster's eyes. It also confirmed a suspicion. Cooper said, "What Harvey Mallon project? I know nothing about that."
"If you don't, you will. It's all Twistle is interested in. He holds seminars every once in a while, and Harvey Mallon's us to death. Everything he does has something to do with Mallon."
And a gentle voice said, "And why not, Associate Plotter?" with the tiniest of emphasis upon Atrell's title. Atrell covered his surprise. He had not heard Twistle enter.
"No reason at all, Senior Computer."
Cooper stiffened. His fair cheeks flushed. His thin features seemed sharper than ever. He stammered, "Senior Computer Twistle?" Atrell watched Cooper's reactions, and a corner of his mouth trembled at the edge of a twitch. He had a good notion of Cooper's feelings. He had seen a similar look, half disbelief and half disappointment, in the eyes of a dozen cubs when they caught their first sight of Eternity's great man. But then, when a man's reputation is colossal and his name magic, it is hard to be faced with the physical reality of a stooped figure, a small round face, a retreating, bald, smooth forehead, little eyes that screwed up into a thousand wrinkles, an ingratiating smile, and a cigarette. The cigarette above all. Cooper looked as though it were the first cigarette he had ever seen. He flinched visibly as a puff of smoke reached him.
"Are you my boy? Are you my youngster?"
Twistle approached Cooper, looking up into his face, as though trying to peer through the cigarette-manufactured haze, and speaking in a horribly accented three-millennial dialect. Cooper said, "I am Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, sir, on assignment and awaiting orders." He spoke a painstakingly slow, school-fresh 60-millennial.
"Oh, formalities."
The senior computer waved a hand with the cigarette in it, and feathery ash was flicked to the polished floor.
"And don't bother with 60-millennial. I have studied your own language much. I speak it wonderfully good. So now, tell me, what is wrong with being interested in Harvey Mallon, Associate Plotter Atrell?"
Atrell recognized it for the rhetorical question it was, and didn't trust himself in any case to speak three-millennial with fluency, so he maintained a strategic silence.
Twistle said, "Isn't he worth study? He's a primitive, so that he cannot be reached in person by Kettle. Yet he invented the temporal field in 2354, and that made the Kettles possible 400 years later. He laid the groundwork for eternity, and yet we don't even know for certain when he was born or when he died. Let me ask my youngster."
He pronounced it youngstar, with the accent on the second syllable, and even to Atrell's inexpert ears that sounded like a vile perversion of what the word ought to be. The senior computer turned to the cub.
"Do you know anything about Harvey Mallon? You are nearer his time. You studied the primitives."
Cooper said, "His life is poorly documented, sir." Twistle smiled.
all you can say, my boy?"
The cigarette between his fingers had burned itself into a stub, and a new one appeared in its place, lighted. The exchange was made with the unobtrusive ease of a lifetime's practice, but to Attrell it seemed, as it always did, like a gratuitous piece of legerdemain. Twistle said to Cooper, "I would offer you a cigarette, but I know you don't smoke. Hardly no one in eternity is smoking smiled upon. In the 72nd only they make good cigarettes, and mine are specially imported from there. It is all very sad. Last week I was stuck in the 123rd for 2 days. No smoking. They don't mind incest in the 123rd, but they would have fainted like old ladies if I had taken out a cigarette. Sometimes I think I should arrange a quantum change and wipe out all the no-smoking taboos in all eternity. But every time I try to figure one out, I find it makes for wars in the 58th or a slave society in the 1000th. Always something." Without any transition in emphasis, he went on to say, "Would you like to witness a quantum change, boy? I've arranged it for you." He seized the cub's elbow and led him out. Attrell's eyes followed them gravely. He had never seen Twistle act so queerly, talk so much. He shrugged. He wasn't going to find out, so why puzzle? He went back to his office and sat down to chart lives in the precise way he had been employing for physio years. In his time, he had plotted the alternate life paths, including all those with a probability higher than 0.01, of 572 individuals in those centuries that lacked decent cancer treatment of any sort. That included the 27th to the 35th inclusive, which had not managed to develop a workable gene technology, and parts of the rather outré 52nd and 53rd, which had reacted violently to physical medicine, including the use of psychic probes and other physical aids to psychoanalysis, by reverting to a brand of psychiatry that bordered strongly on faith healing. Of all the 572 whose life paths he had plotted, exactly 17 had benefited as a result. Or at least, extension of the lifetimes of 17 had been found to involve no quantum changes of negative value, and their premature deaths by cancer had been averted. The treatment was expensive, but still the government officials in those centuries clamored for more. More anti-cancer serums shipped across time at any expense. More lives to be saved. Attrell knew well that rather than more, fewer would be saved. It was Twistle's favorite thesis. With each quantum change for the benefit of mankind, the next quantum change would grow harder to find. Never impossible, but always harder. Attrell sighed. Would the day come when no lifetime in all of time could be altered? When human history would finally follow the ideal path? The Alwyn Council said no. In an infinite number of paths, there could be no one ideal. It could only be approached asymptotically. Forever approached, never reached. He bent over the lifetime of Lyman Hugh Shapur of the 29th century and retraced the queer double fork he had not yet quite succeeded in interpreting. Let's see now. 3. Anders Horum, native of the 95th century, stiffly restrictive of atomic power, faintly rustic, fond of natural wood as a structural material, exporters of certain types of distilled potables to nearly everyone, and importers of clover seed, took the kettle to the 2,456th century. His sallow face, with its long cheeks and thin lips, was calm. He showed no nervousness in the face of a delicate job that would not bear botching. It never occurred to him that he could possibly botch a quantum change. So far, his self-confidence had not been misplaced. Horum had started his career in eternity as an observer. While computers remained in the rarefied atmosphere of their mathematical labors, and life plotters delved into the wearily endless jungle of infinite possibility, and socials spun their fragile theories concerning men and things, the observer went steadily out into time and brought back the raw data that fed them all. For this, the observer gets little credit. The literature of eternity rings with applause for the brilliancies of computing, the delicacies of plotting, the intelligence of socializing, but little is said of the observer who collects the facts, and less still of the technician, whose hand pulls the string that changes the lives of billions. Horum had been a technician for 5 years now. For most of that time, he had worked directly with Twistle. Twistle told him what he must do, and for that Twistle was honored. Horum did as Twistle told him, and for that Horum was disliked.
It was as though the Eternals, unable to avoid the collective guilt involved in playing God with the lives of generations, compromised by placing upon the technician's shoulders the load of that guilt. In his observations of those societies that practiced capital punishment, Horam had noticed the same social distinction between the respected judge who ordered execution done and the civil servant who carried out the order at the cost of social ostracism. Horam felt no bitterness concerning this. He was dourly glad to be a technician working for Twissel. There was nothing for which he would have changed his position. Above all else, he was devoutly pleased to be working on what Twissel called the Malin Mystery. It was Horam himself who had penetrated Eras on errands the results of which had been entered in no public record books. It was he himself who had followed lives that Twissel would not trust to professional plotters. It was he himself who had first located Brinsley, Sheridan, Cooper, and his sluggish blood had caught fire when he learned that here, at last, was he for whom Twissel had been seeking. He personally had gone down when, as far back in Cooper's life as Twissel had dared reach, to get Cooper first into Cub School, then into the proper sort of specialized training. Then, when the minimum of training had passed, it was Horam who had sent the message in Twissel's name, ordering Cooper to the 575th. It was all well. If Horam were a man given to smiling, he would have smiled now. In the hyper-isolation of a kettle passing up the corridors of the endless centuries, he might even have laughed aloud. But he felt only the cold satisfaction of a physio-decade of painstaking work approaching its climax as he watched the centuries vanish through and beyond his kettle. Then the kettle came to its smooth automatic halt, and reality solidified out of the vague mists that had surrounded it. Horam did not even pause to note the novel facets that any century must possess to new eyes, even on the first and most trivial acquaintance. He was too old a hand to waste his time on any observations not immediately useful. In any case, he was only in that section of eternity given over to the 2456, and not in the time itself. The barrier that separated eternity from time was dark with the darkness of primeval chaos, and its velvety non-light was characteristically speckled with the flitting points of light that mirrored submicroscopic imperfections of the fabric that could not be eradicated while the uncertainty principle existed. Horam adjusted the position of the barrier quietly, and then stepped through into the exact second of time indicated by spatio-temporal analysis to be optimal for his purpose. The barrier flamed up into unfelt brilliance as mass traveled across it, moving from eternity into time. 1,000,000 tons of matter disintegrated each second to feed the barriers that dotted eternity, but energy was no problem. 20 billions of years upwind blazed the final nova that was once Sol, and 1,000,000 sun-power of energy was there for the taking. That, at least, was constant. No conceivable change of reality, no possible alteration in the petty human affairs of time, could ever alter the coming of that nova. Horam found himself in an engine room. It was empty, and it would stay empty for 2 hours and 36 minutes under the present reality, for 2 minutes longer under the reality to come. His own presence here, as careful calculation showed, was neutral. While no entrance into time, however casual, could fail to impose a finite distortion on the fabric of reality, not all distortions reach the minimum level required to make an actual quantum change. What Horam did next was apparently even more trivial than the mere fact of his presence. He lifted a small container from its position on a shelf to an empty spot in the shelf below. Having done that, he re-entered eternity in a way that seemed to him as prosaic as passage through any door might be. To an observer pinned in time, it would seem that he had disappeared. The small container stayed where he put it. It played no immediate role in world history. A man's hand reached for it and did not find it. A search revealed it half an hour later, but in the interim a force field had blanked out and a man's temper had been lost. A decision that would have remained unmade in a previous reality was now made in anger. A meeting did not take place. A man who would have died lived a year longer. And one who would have lived a day longer died a day sooner. The ripples spread wider. From the moment that container had been shifted, through all of time thereafter, a new reality existed. In some centuries, the change was extreme, with whole cultures subtly altered. In some centuries, the change was slight. Nowhere was it zero. But, of course, no human being in time could ever possibly be aware of any change having taken place.
And though millions of men did not live who, but for Horam's touch, would have, the Eternals understood, and except for irrational instinct, none could consider Horam a murderer. Except, of course, Horam himself. 4. Laban's whistle had been a fixture in Eternity for so long that few living could remember an Eternity without him. It was freely stated that he had been immersed in the problems of mankind for so long that he had forgotten the exact number of the century of his birth. It was also said that at an early age his heart had atrophied, and that a hand computer similar to the model he carried always in his trouser pocket had taken its place. Twistle did nothing to deny these rumors. In fact, he rather believed them himself. It would have mortified him if he were told that any of his inner excitement was visible, that his hand-computer heart might be thumping with indecent haste, as though it were only muscle and valves after all. He was looking at Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, actually looking at him, and none knew outside himself and that odd fish Horam that this undistinguished, nervous youth was everything. They were climbing into the kettle. Its sides were perfectly round, and it fit snugly inside the vertical shaft. Twistle set the controls with one hand. The other, of course, manipulated his cigarette. There was the little stir, not spin, not motion, that meant the kettle was moving through eternity. He smiled at Cooper. "Are you troubled, youngster?" Cooper's eyes followed the passing of the spinning numbers. "To when are we going, sir?" Twistle said, 2781. Not far. A walk. A little walk." "The 2781st? You've never been so far?" "Until today, Computer Twistle, I'd never been further upwind than the 40th. "So? Are you afraid?" Cooper stirred in his seat. "It's over 200,000 years from home." "An Eternal has no home. You should learn that, boy," said Twistle softly. The numbers came and went, increasing. Cooper said, "How far upwind have you ever gone, sir?"
200,000 centuries, I think. More or less. It's not worthwhile going any further, except for the engineers who capped Nova Sol. About then, the 200,000th, humanity leaves Earth."
The old computer studied the other's uneasy face.
"They didn't teach you that in school, I suppose?"
"I was very specialized in the other direction, sir," Cooper replied, weighing his words. But Twistle let them lie there. He said, "But man does leave this old world eventually."
"Why?"
"It's not known exactly. Entry into time stopped some centuries before the departure. Some say it's evolution. Men become something other than men. Some say it's science. Men finally learn the secret of the hyperspace drive and can reach the stars."
"There's no reason they should leave Earth, though."
Twistle said, "Some people think they leave to escape us and our eternal fiddling with reality."
"Can't we make them stay?"
"Why should we? Is there not enough work in our 200,000 centuries of eternity?"
"What happens after they leave?"
"Nothing. Eternity goes on without mankind until the sun blows up, and then it goes on without the sun until entropy is maximum and all the stars are dead, and then it just goes on. There is no end to eternity."
The numbers came to a halt, and Twistle led the way into an anteroom, mirror-lined.
"Molecular films fashionable here," said Twistle with distaste. "Pseudo-liquids."
He led Cooper past respectful Eternals, to whom he paid no attention, and marched into a small observation room. Cooper stared at his own reflection, duplicated with disconcerting frequency. He said,
"Is everything mirrors?"
"Just about. A posturing generation. They can adjust to less reflection, though." With a sweep of his hand over unobtrusive controls, he toned the mirrors down to a slate-gray diffuseness, in which he and Cooper were the barest shadows. He sat down and said,
"We have yet a small wait."
The bare chair frame grew upholstery as his body approached it, a smooth red upholstery shaped to fit Twistle's anatomy. Cooper sat down cautiously, and upholstery grew beneath him also. Twistle's withered hand cupped a contact,
and the nearer wall melted into glassiness. Figures and objects sharpened. Cooper gasped.
What is it, sir?
A spaceport. Spaceships leave from here and move through the solar system along lines of electrogravitic force. Quite useless.
But it's beautiful.
Nothing is beautiful if it is bought at the price of misery. This is an unhappy century, and the last few quantum changes have tended to make it unhappier. Now, finally, something must be done. The poor creatures go to Mars, but there isn't anything on Mars. There never was. There never will be. On Earth, they turn to drugs. The 2781st has the highest incidence of drug addiction in eternity.
They must be awfully advanced technologically.
You're 28, also a technological century, so you're impressed. Listen, child, do you know how many times space travel has developed along the centuries?
27 times.
It never lasts more than a millennium or two. People get tired. They come back home. The colonies die out. Then another 4 or 5 millennia, or 40 or 50, and they try again. When I first came to eternity, there were 34 space travel periods.
Are the computers quanting space travel out of reality?
Not at all. Why should we? There was a time when there were only 14 space travel periods, and then it moved up again. We of eternity just improve reality. Where improvement leads, we follow. One time it may wipe out space travel here. The next it may restore it there.
Cooper watched the shining green metal of the hangars and the brilliant gleam of the steel ships, lifting silently and smoothly on the mass-free lines of force that bind the planets. Twiffle watched Cooper rather than the scene, and let smoke rise smoothly and undisturbed from his cigarette. Cooper said tremulously,
"Out there it's so far from home, when?"
He added suddenly, "My mother is dead out there for over 250,000 years.
Twiffle glanced at the boy sharply and said,
"Your mother exists?"
Cooper shrugged and said in a muffled voice,
"I don't know. Quantum changes hardly ever come that near the beginning of eternity. Maybe she does. After I came to eternity, though, Manfield told me never to check."
"Manfield was quite right. You're a foolish lad even to think of such things."
"I'm sorry, sir."
"Well, you're forgiven.
Watch now. 3 centuries downwind, Horum is displacing the mesolite crystals. The moment in physiotime is upon us, eh?"
Cooper cried out sharply,
"The spaceport!"
The shininess was gone. The building shrank. A spaceship rusted. Motion died.
"Is this what you expected, sir?" asked Cooper.
"Quite. Space travel decayed a century sooner than otherwise. But no drugs. Happier people. Improvements in other areas you know nothing about."
Unconsciously, Twiffle had slipped into his own dialect. He caught that and reverted back to Cooper's tongue, and his irritation at the slip sharpened his words.
"Idiot! Do you cry over metal? Don't you care about people? I warn you, if you place matter over man, you are not fit for eternity."
Then, with instant contrition, his tone changed radically.
"No. No, Cooper. I scold you for something you cannot help. Come with me now. I just wanted you to see this to give you insight, so that you might understand more. But now come. More important business lies ahead of us. The most important business in all eternity."
5. Anders Horum was returning by kettle from the 2456. The anteroom of the 2456, through which he had passed in going from kettle to time and from time to kettle, had been glaringly and obviously empty. The Eternals of that section of eternity knew that a technician was at work, and they preferred neither to see him nor to speak to him. In his own chill way, Horum understood the reasons. None of the Eternals of that section were natives of the 2456. Naturally. One of the prime rules of eternity was that no man might be associated officially with his own homeland. The possibilities of corruption, if that rule didn't exist, were too apparent to discuss.
Still, the passage of a technician through a barrier would remind all men sharply that their own homewind might suffer in the next quantum change. And though all Eternals' minds were educated to know that, if so, it was inevitable and even desirable, hearts, even of Eternals, are not always amenable to education. Unless, of course, it was the heart of such a man as himself, the technician thought, and frowned as he thought so. Many a time he had been held up to Cubs as an example. Devotion to duty and consciousness of a mission that transcended any personal considerations were all that should go into the makeup of an Eternal, it was said. Horam had once lived earnestly by that rule in the days when he was a simple observer, slithering out of Eternity to collect data, quietly, unobtrusively, efficiently. Whenever possible, he used the homes of timed employees of Eternity as a base. When it was inexpedient to do so, he stayed at hotels, if the spatio-temporal charts allowed, slept under hedges if they insisted. Always, at every penetration, the charts were most meticulous as to where he might go and when, what he might and might not do. Always, with an efficiency that now made him Twistle's prize technician, he invaded no forbidden areas of people, space, or time. At no time in his career had the fabric of reality tottered because he had passed the bounds. What he had just done was an example. His deed had to be pinpointed in space-time for optimal results. It was the equivalent of the surgeon's sure cut, the engineer's deft twist. It was he who supplied the MNC. No Eternal thought of the minimum necessary cause as anything but MNC, using his own method after the computer had pointed out the general nature of the MNC required. It was Twistle, 3 centuries later in time, who observed the MSR, maximum significant result, they taught you to say in school. Typical. The technician instituted the little disgraceful cause. The computer watched the large honorable result. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered but the great work that lay immediately ahead, now that the cub, Cooper, had come. He shuddered very slightly. The thought had come to him, unwanted, of his first physio year in the 482nd. He did not know what the era was like now. He avoided reading about it. He had avoided assignments near it. But he remembered so clearly how it had been when he finished school and received his first assignment in Eternity. Observer in the 482nd and neighboring centuries. Observer, objective and cold, incapable of seeing anything other than it was. Observer, the man whose job was never done, since every quantum change more or less voided all observational data on the centuries involved. He had brought back his first report on the 482nd and made certain that he remained objective and cold. He made certain that none of his inner disapproval showed. It was an era without ethics or principles, as he was accustomed to think of such. It was hedonistic, materialistic, more than a little matriarchal. It was the only era in which ectogenic birth flourished, and at its peak, 40% of its women gave eventual birth by merely contributing a fertilized ovum to the ovarian. Marriage was made and unmade by mutual consent, and was considered a purely emotional arrangement. Union for the sake of childbearing was, of course, divorced from the merely social functions of marriage, and was decided on by purely eugenic principles. In 100 other ways, Horam thought the society sick and hungered for a quantum change. His jaw tightened with thrilling anticipation as he thought of the millions of pleasure-seeking women, the men were of no account, really, who would find themselves true, pure-hearted mothers in another reality, with all the memories that belonged with it, unable to tell, dream, or fancy that they had ever been anything else. Millions living would, in a moment, never have lived. And other millions would come into existence, convinced as a matter of course that they possessed ancestors and childhoods, and in their reality that would be true. But his report showed none of his feeling, and he knew must not. It was not until Nois Lambent first entered his sector of Eternity as computer Hob Finge's secretary that his disapproval of the era and all its work first broke surface. Horam viewed all timed employees with suspicion. Ideally, he thought, none but Eternals should ever be found within Eternity. The presence of ordinary timed individuals made necessary 1,000 precautions. But naturally, the computers always insisted there were 1,000 reasons for their use. Nois Lambent, however, was past 10,000 reasons, or so it seemed to Horam. After 2 days, he walked determinedly into the office of Hob Finge, associate computer. Finge was dead now. a plump and smiling nearsighted man from an energy-centered century somewhere in the 600s, who always seemed surprised to find himself sitting on something made of mere flimsy matter and who treaded cautiously on the flooring for fear it would break under his weight. Horam made his point instantly.
"Computer Finch, I protest the hiring of Miss Lambent."
"Ah, Horam."
Finch looked up, smiling.
"Sit down, sit down. You find Miss Lambent incompetent, unsuitable."
"I cannot say whether she is incompetent or not," said Horam sharply. "I have not made use of her services, nor do I intend to. She is your secretary. But she is certainly unsuitable."
It was not politic to speak so to a superior, but Horam in his youth had been an idealist about eternity, and he felt it necessary to make his protest at any cost. Finch stared at him distantly, as though his computer's mind were weighing abstractions beyond the reach of an ordinary eternal.
"In what way is she unsuitable, Horam?"
"I'm amazed you need ask, computer. Her costume is most disgraceful."
"Oh, come.
I cannot help having noticed that she wears very little above the waist." His hands moved vaguely about at chest level. "Besides that, her levity is disgusting."
"I am sure, Horam, her clothes and attitude are part of the mores of her time. You, as an observer, should be aware of that."
"In its own surroundings, in its own cultural milieu, I would have no fault to find with her character. Here in eternity, however, a person such as she is out of place."
Finch grinned. He actually grinned, and Horam would have stiffened if any slack in his body had remained. Finch said,
"I hired her deliberately. She is performing an essential function. It is only temporary. Try to endure her meanwhile."
Horam's jaw tightened. He had protested, and he had been fobbed off. It would do no good to ask what the essential function was. A computer never explained, certainly not to an observer. One couldn't buck the mental aristocracy that ruled eternity. He turned stiffly, walked to the door. Finch's voice stopped him.
Finch said, "Observer, have you ever had a..."
He hesitated, seemed to pick among words.
"Girlfriend?"
With painstaking and insulting accuracy, Horam quoted, "In the interest of avoiding emotional entanglements with time, an eternal may not marry. In the interest of avoiding emotional entanglements with family, an eternal may not have children." The computer said gravely,
"I didn't ask about marriage or children."
Horam quoted further,
"Temporary liaisons may be made with inhabitants of time only after application with the Central Charting Board for an appropriate spatio-temporal chart."
"Quite true. Have you ever applied, observer?"
"No, computer."
"Well, perhaps you ought to, Horam. It would give you a greater breadth of view. You would become less concerned about the details of a woman's costume."
Horam left, speechless with rage. He worked harder than ever thereafter, and hated the era more. He ignored the offending employee, but was always aware of her presence. Somehow, without ever inquiring directly, he learned that her name was Noyes Lambent, and that she was independently wealthy, accountable to no one, an aristocrat in her time. Why, then, should she wish to work in eternity? How could she fulfill a secretary's duties? His suspicions of Finch were strong. Finch spoke coarsely of liaisons, even recommended such relations. Eternity had always been aware of the necessity of compromising with human appetite. To Horam, the phrase carried a quivery repulsion. But the restrictions involved in choosing mistresses made the compromise anything but a generous one. Among the lower groupings of Eternals, there were always the rumors, half-hopeful, half-resentful, of women imported on a more or less permanent basis for the obvious reasons. Always, rumor pointed to the computers as the benefiting group. They and only they could decide which women could be abstracted from time without quantum change of reality. Such rumors remained rumors. No case had ever been proven against specific offenders, and Horam had always dismissed such things as the vaporings of idle minds. But now he suspected Finch. A woman like that, his secretary? He knew other words for it. He met the woman in a corridor one day and stood aside, eyes averted, to let her pass. But she remained standing, looking at him.
"You're Observer Horam, aren't you?"
He nodded briefly, coldly.
I'm told you're quite an expert on our time.
Will you pass, or let me pass, please?
He could not help but look at her, and she smiled at him and moved by with a slow swing of her hips that brought his chill blood tingling to his angry cheeks. Angry against himself for reddening, at her for speaking to him, and most of all, for some obscure reason, at Finch.
Finch called him in 2 weeks later. On his desk were the familiar perforated flimsies which the Alwyn Council periodically sent. On appropriate scanning by Horam's instrument, they would become the spatio-temporal chart that would send him out into time on another mission. Finch said,
"Would you sit down, Horam? Scan it right now."
Horam did as he was told, stopped at midpoint, and tore the flimsies from his scanner as though they were on the point of exploding. He held them between thumb and index finger. "Computer, Finch, there is some mistake."
Finch said, "I think not. Why do you say so?"
"Surely I am not to be expected to use the home of this woman, Lambent, as base." The computer pursed his lips.
"Such is my understanding. Ordinarily, Observer, I would expect you to carry out your mission without question. In this case, since you have gone to the extent of expressing official displeasure concerning Miss Lambent, I thought I would explain some of the aspects of the present problem."
Finch was speaking carefully, a little stiffly, and Horam sat motionless, not looking at his superior. Make him come all the way, he thought. Ordinarily, professional pride would have forced Horam to disdain explanation. His not to make reply, reason why, and all the rest of it. But here he felt a certain vengefulness that suggested that just a little bending of professional honor might be well. Horam had complained, that was it. Finch was fearful that the complaint might go further, that the Alwyn Council might investigate the exact function of Finch's blatant secretary. Finch was forced to give Horam this new mission, since Horam was his best man. But if Horam were placed too near the girl, he might find out too much. Finch feared that. Finch would try to explain it all away in advance. Horam, grimly amused at the prospect, was prepared to listen, but not to believe. Finch said, "Of course the various centuries are aware of the existence of eternity. They know that we supervise intertemporal trade, and they consider that to be our chief function, which is good. They have a dim knowledge that we are also here to prevent catastrophe from striking mankind, which is more or less correct. We supply the generations with a mass father image and a certain feeling of security, so we would want them to know about us in any case. There are some things, however, they must not know. Prime among them is our function in altering the path of reality by quantum changes. It was established long ago that the insecurity arising from any knowledge that reality could be altered at will would work to great disadvantage. So we have always bred such possible knowledge out of reality and have never been troubled with it. However, there are always other undesirable beliefs about eternity that spring up from time to time in one century or another. Usually the dangerous beliefs are those that concentrate particularly in the ruling classes of an era, the classes that have most contact with us, and that carry the important weight of what is called public opinion. This is always distressing, because in eliminating such dangerous beliefs we must induce reality changes that often negate hard-won advances in other fields, which must then be re-won by sometimes complicated means." Finch paused as though he expected Horam to offer some comment, or ask some question. Horam did neither. Finch continued, "Ever since the quantum change that last affected the 482nd seriously, the Alwyn Council has been aware of certain undesirable aspects of the new reality here. It was nothing of a sufficiently gross nature to be apparent on extrapolations even down to the fifth order, which was as far as we could go in this case without increasing the probability error to a prohibitive degree. For that reason, we have been concentrating on new observation here, and you have been kept busy, Horam. I might say that new computing shows the focus of disturbance rests in a rather unprecedented attitude of timed people toward eternity. The Alwyn Council is reluctant to accept the results without direct observational confirmation. It was for that reason that I located a member of the aristocracy who thought it would be thrilling or exciting to work in eternity. I kept her under close observation to see if she was suitable for our purpose." Horam thought, "Close observation, yes." Again his anger focused itself on Finch rather than upon the woman.
Finch was continuing. By all standards, she is suitable. We will now return her to time. Using her dwelling as a base, you will be able to study the social life of her circle, taking due heed of the precautions outlined in the chart. I'll just emphasize the point that you are observing the cultural milieu of a small and specific circle, and that Miss Lambent offers an ideal tool for the purpose. Now do you understand her function here? To a direct question, Horam had to answer. I do, computer. You are willing to accept the mission? Horam could not resist a parting thrust. I am an observer with a duty. My manner of performing that duty is independent of explanations. Horam left with the comforting thought that while expressing himself with the high idealism to be expected of an Eternal, he had nevertheless made the point that Finge's complicated explanation, how long had it taken him to work it all out, had left Horam untouched. Almost buried in that thought was another, that a new quantum change might be approaching for the 482nd, one that perhaps might wipe out the immorality of the times and install decency in its place. Noyes Lambent's house was fairly isolated, yet within easy reach of one of the larger cities of the century. Horam had memorized the map of the city, as he had memorized others. He knew its avenues and its buildings, its transport lines, its habits of life. He knew the exact portions he must observe on each of the days of his assignment, when he might make each trip, when he must remain at base. His first conversation with Noyes Lambent in her own time came about as the result of her excitement when she discovered her slight temporal displacement. She came to him breathlessly. "It's June, Observer Horam." He said harshly, "Do not use my title here. What if it is June?"
"But it was February when I joined..."
She paused archly.
"That place, and that was only a month ago."
Horam frowned. "What year is it now?"
"Oh, it's the same year."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm quite positive."
She had a disturbing habit of standing quite close to him as they talked, and her slight lisp, a trait of the century rather than of herself personally, gave her the sound of a young and rather helpless child. Horam was not fooled by that. He drew away. "Are you usually in this house during the spring?"
"No, I have a place at the Middle Sea."
Horam knew the region under its earlier name of Mediterranean. He said, "Then your friends would expect your absence during the interval, wouldn't they?"
"I see," she said thoughtfully. "You mean it would look funny if I were to come back in April?"
"Exactly. We are careful about such things in Eternity." He said it proudly, as though he himself were a senior computer. She said,
"But then, have I lost 3 months in my life?"
"Your movements through time have nothing to do with your physiological age."
"Does that mean I have or I haven't?"
"You haven't."
"Why do you act so angry with me?"
asked Noyes Lambent on the second evening. Her arms and shoulders were bare, and her long legs shimmered in faintly luminescent fomite. The spatio-temporal chart confined Horam to the house during the later hours of the day, and he ate dinner there, picking sparingly at dishes that had been entered in previous reports of his on the dietary of the times, but which he had thus far refrained from eating himself. Against his will, he liked them. Against his will, he enjoyed the foaming, light green, peppermint-flavored drink that went with the meal. He said, "I am not angry. I have no feeling for you at all." At the moment, he felt the statement to be rigidly true. They were alone together in the house. In this era, with the female of the species economically independent and able to attain motherhood if she so wished, without the necessity of physical childbearing, the relationships between the sexes involved no rules worthy of the name. It was nothing to be remarked at if a young woman entertained male guests. She was rather an object of pity if she did not. Horam knew this thoroughly, and yet he felt compromised. The meal was over. She poured him another of the tall, lightly foaming drinks. He felt a little warm and somewhat breathless, and stirred about in the soft chair to find a more comfortable position. The girl was stretched out on her elbow on a sofa opposite. Its patterned covering sank beneath her as though avid to embrace her. She had kicked off the transparent shoes she had been wearing, and her toes curled and uncurled as though they were the soft paws of a luxuriant cat.
"It was fun working for Eternity,"
she said, sighing, "and I waited the longest time for them to let me." She was watching him. Her dark hair had loosened at some point in the evening and fell about her neck and naked shoulders, which stood out creamily in contrast. He didn't answer. She murmured, "How old are you?" That he certainly should not have answered. It was a personal question, and the answer was none of her business. He heard himself saying, 25 years. He meant physio years, of course. She said, "I'm only 22, but you'll live and live and be young, and I'll be gone so many years." "What are you talking about?" He rubbed his forehead to clear his mind. She said, "You live forever. You're an eternal." Was it a question or a statement? He said, "You're mad. We grow old and die like anyone else." She said, "You can tell me." Her voice was low and cajoling. The 50-millennial language, which he had always thought harsh and unpleasant, seemed euphonious after all. Or was it merely that a full stomach and the scented air had dulled his ears? She said, "You can see all times, visit all places. I'd love to be an eternal. Why aren't more women eternals?" He couldn't trust himself to speak. What could he say? That members of eternity were chosen with infinite care, since two conditions had to be met. First, they must be equipped for the job. Second, their withdrawal from time must have no deleterious effect upon reality. Reality. He must not mention that. How many excellent prospects had been left untouched because their removal into eternity meant the non-birth of children, the non-death of men and women, non-marriage, non-happenings, non-circumstances that would have twisted reality in directions the Alwyn Council could not permit? Could he tell her that women almost never qualified for eternity because, for some reason he did not understand, computers might, but he was merely an observer, their abstraction from time was over 10 times more likely to distort reality than was the abstraction of a man? All the thoughts jumbled together in his head until he could not tell one from another. They seemed lost and embedded in a vague buzzing that wasn't entirely unpleasant. She was closer to him now, smiling. He heard her voice like a drifting wind. "Oh, you eternals, make me one." He wanted. He longed to tell her. "There's no fun in eternity, lady. We work. We work to plot out all the details of every when, from the beginning of eternity to where Earth is empty. And we try to plot out all the infinite possibilities of all the might-have-beens and pick out a might-have-been that is better than what is, and decide where in time we can make a tiny little change to twist the is to the might-be. And we have a new is, and look for a new might-be. Forever and forever and forever and..." He shook his head, but the whirligig of thought went on. The drink? The peppermint drink? She was yet closer, her face not quite clear. He could feel her hair against his cheek, the warm light pressure of her breath. He ought to draw away, but strangely, he found he did not want to. "If I were made an eternal," she breathed, almost in his ear, though the words sounded distantly above the beating of his heart. Her lips were moist and parted. "If I were an eternal..." He put out his arms clumsily, gropingly. She did not resist, but melted and coalesced with him. It all happened dreamily, as though it were happening to someone else. It wasn't nearly as repulsive as he had always imagined it must be. And afterward, she leaned against him with her eyes glittering and whispering, "Eternity, eternity," over and over. The spatio-temporal chart had not allowed this. Yet, for some reason, it was only the thought of Finge that aroused strong emotion in Horam's breast at that moment. Nor was it guilt, either. Rather, satisfaction. Even triumph. Eventually, he returned to eternity, but before he left Noise, he kissed her hands and held her tightly. He almost smiled at Finge as he presented his report. Finge did not look up, but glanced over the puncture pattern, as though his practiced eye were converting words and phrases into symbols, as though somewhere in his mathematical mind the meshings of equations were already taking place. He said casually,
"This will be checked. And what happened to you, Horam?"
"To me, computer?" muttered Horam, his feeling of assurance suddenly gone.
Yes. You spent one evening alone in the lady's house. You did, didn't you? You followed the chart.
I did, sir.
Well, are all pertinent details included in your report?
Finch's eyes were keenly upon him, and the habit of duty tugged at Horam. An observer must report everything. Ideally, an observer was merely a sense-perceptive pseudopod thrown out by eternity. He had no individuality of his own in the performance of his duty. Horam's lower lip trembled momentarily, not with fear, anger, or embarrassment, but with the sudden memory of that evening's exaltation. He began his narration of the events he had left out of his report. And then Finch raised his hand and said sharply,
"Thank you. It is enough."
Horam went back to his desk filled with a spiritual wine. Of course Finch would ask about it, and of course the man could not bear to hear it. Finch was jealous. To Horam that was obvious, and for the first time in his life he knew an aim that meant more to him than the frigid fulfillment of eternity. He was going to keep Finch jealous, and all the world beside if he had to, because he was going to keep noise in the face of Finch, the Alwyn Council, and all of eternity. Horam's first request for permission to enter the century on non-official business was entered 2 days later. He had meant to wait a discreet 5 days, but couldn't. It was refused. He had more than half expected that. He entered Computer Finch's office trembling with all the words he had to say. He began, "A request for my entry into the century has been rejected." Finch interrupted at once.
"You wish to see Miss Lambent?"
"Yes." He put all the defiance he could manage into the monosyllable.
"There's been a quantum change. I thought you realized that."
Horam went white. He had forgotten. "A quantum change?"
"Whatever else did you think we needed information for?"
"A quantum change?"
"A comparatively small one, to be sure."
"Then..."
"But Miss Lambent doesn't exist. Except in the minds of those of us in eternity who knew her, she never existed. The new reality excludes her. She was never born."
Horam stumbled backward into a chair.
Finch said, "I explained. I told you of the difficulties we had with times where inexpedient ideas grow up about eternity. The 482nd was one of them. From what information we did have, we came indirectly to the conclusion that among the upper classes of the era, particularly among the women, the notion grew that eternals were really eternal, that they lived forever."
Horam remembered Noyes' statement, short and straightforward.
"You live forever."
But he had denied it. It was with a tremendous effort that he kept from screaming. Finch was talking.
"Worse than that, the superstition had arisen that intimacy with an eternal would enable a mortal woman, as they thought of themselves, to live forever."
Horam could hear her voice again so clearly.
"If I were an eternal, make me one."
The words he heard drowned in the stronger memory of her kisses. Finch went on.
"This was hard to believe, Horam. It was unprecedented. If true, the belief and the causes giving rise to it had to be removed. But before we could act, we needed a direct check. We chose Miss Lambent as a good example of the class. We chose you as the other subject."
Horam struggled to his feet. "You chose me as a subject?"
"It was unusual. Necessity?"
"Damn necessity. You're lying." He didn't care what he said now. Finch's eyes widened. His plump lips quivered.
"How dare you, observer?"
"I say you're lying," Horam shouted. "You're jealous. You had your own plans for Noyes, but she chose me. Me. You're trying to tell me that she acted as she did because she wanted to live forever, and I tell you, no. It wasn't at all like that. And your lies won't cheapen it for me and won't hide her from me. She exists, and I'll go out there and..." The words seemed to fade in Horam's ears, though he was screaming with all the force his lungs could muster. The red mist before his eyes darkened and swirled. He felt the pressure of the floor against his cheek, yet he was not conscious of pain at first. Then the pain came. His fingers were crooked against the floor as though trying to grip it. Finge's hated voice was in his ears, but the words were not addressed to him. Finge was talking into a communo. Horam could tell that much, even in his helplessness. Horam heard what he said without having the capacity to rise from the ground and throttle the man. Finge was saying,
"Slightest idea that it would have such an effect."
Yes, he was the logical choice, almost the only choice.
Inhibited, prudish, unprepossessing.
The fact that the girl deliberately...
She did.
It was unmistakably deliberate.
His report made it quite clear.
I refer you to the addendum.
Yes, hospitalization and rehabilitation, certainly.
He's one of our best men in his way. I wouldn't want to lose him.
Hospitalization and rehabilitation. It took months of physio time, but when it was over, all who had ever known Horam would have sworn he was himself again. And so he might have been, except that there now existed something that had not existed before.
Noise.
What use to say she did not exist?
She existed in his mind.
And while he lived, she would always exist in his mind, and there would be no other woman.
To that resolve he adhered. He brought, or rather dragged, from the bottom of his soul, a still firmer and more impersonal efficiency in his job than even he had ever shown before. He climbed through the various levels of the observer classification to those of technician. He attracted the attention of no less a man than Senior Computer Twistle, and was, at Twistle's own request, assigned to him as personal technician. In the past 3 years, he himself, personally, had misplaced objects, put out lights, adjusted switches, abstracted personal communications, and done 101 unimportant things, each of which had brought to non-existence so many persons and things, and to new existence so many others. But he no longer cared what left reality, and of all things that entered it, not one was noise. In the first year after the catastrophe, he had somehow deluded himself into hoping that somewhere in the times, as quantum changes came and went, Noise Lambent would be recreated. But deeper knowledge said no. And as physio time passed, he had to admit that no. Out of the infinite number of possible realities, the chance that one would be chosen with noise in it was one out of an infinite number, or, bluntly and horribly, zero. And then, when the weight of futility might have borne down everything, there came a new aim in life. He didn't realize what it was all at once. The thought grew slowly, but for its sake, Horam endured life, work, and Computer Twistle. He bore with the senior computer's pettiness and trivialities. He bore with all the follies to which genius seemed to entitle him. Most of all, he bore with the man's burning, smoking cylinders of paper and weed, a vice he had never heard of, let alone experienced, in his earlier years. He breathed the foul smoke, choking and gagging on it, and never, by word or glance, scarcely by thought, did he complain. All for the sake of Twistle's great project. Today, on this day, as he returned from his errand to the 2456th, that project was to come to fruition. Today it was to happen, with the arrival of the young Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, whom Horam himself had painfully tracked down out of how many quintillion possibilities with an ardor and devotion that transcended mere duty. 6. Cooper was quiet on the trip back from the 2781st. He was a little sick. There had been people bustling through that spaceport. There had been none doing so afterward. It didn't mean they were all non-existent, necessarily. They were elsewhere, with different lives and different memories. And if some had never been, others were newly there. It was all for the better, he told himself. All for the better. The kettle spun downwind and downwind, slipping through the centuries. When the kettle halted and they were back at the 575th, the old computer wrinkled his forehead into horizontal furrows and said,
"You don't feel well, youngster?"
"I'm all right, sir," demurred Cooper, unconvincingly.
"Come this way to my office," said Twistle.
They passed groups who stepped aside and made way. Their greetings made a continuous murmur, but Twistle returned none. Cooper, embarrassed, kept his eyes on the ground and hastened at the great man's hurrying heels. He was grateful when they entered a room and a door closed behind them. Clean porcelain made an antiseptic enclosure. One wall of the office was crowded from floor to ceiling with the little computing units which together made up the largest privately operated computerplex in Eternity, and indeed one of the largest altogether. The opposite wall was crammed with reference films. Between the two, what was left of the room was almost a corridor, broken by a desk, two chairs, recording and projecting equipment, and a strange object for which Cooper could imagine no use until he saw Twistle flick the malodorant remnants of a cigarette into it. It flashed noiselessly, and Twistle, in his usual prestidigitous fashion, held another in his hand. Cooper wondered how it would be if someday his own work would be used as the basis for a quantum change. If someday he would say, "Here and now, change!" Could he bear it? His instructor, Manfield, had warned them once. "No man," he said, "can control the lives of all mankind and feel no guilt. It is for that reason that even the greatest computers are careful to subject even the simplest analogical extrapolations to machine analysis. The machine must take all the blame and all the responsibility. And even then..." Manfield withdrew into himself at that moment and did not complete the sentence. Another time, at one of the informal after-dinner sessions he held regularly with his five boys, Manfield said, "Why must changes in reality be so radical, eh? Why not ultra-fine alterations that would change a life here and there and no more? Why must whole centuries be wrenched from their moorings?" His sad, placid face reddened and became strangely like that of a passionate man, which he was not. He said, "Think about it, gentlemen. Someday you'll be reciting formulas to explain it, but will that be enough? When 10 generations of men have been twisted and remolded, at your instance, to undo or redo the work of 6 individuals, will the pious mutter of an equation suffice? You must therefore understand the necessity for it. It is easy to think that every little gesture introduced into reality will change it. Every additional step and glance, every cough, every nod. These so tiny stimuli should produce so tiny changes, but they won't. Gentlemen, they won't. Reality has a stability of its own. Push it a little, and like a rowboat in a pond, it may rock, but it won't capsize. It will restore itself to its original position. To change reality at all, you must push hard enough to make it jump its tracks, if you will allow me to mix my metaphors. Just as matter and energy exist in discrete particles or quanta, so does reality. And quantum changes are large. They must be. So you will never have a choice, gentlemen. If you are to help mankind at all, you must be prepared to interfere with 1 billion lives at a stroke. The rowboat must be capsized, not rocked." Then, quite suddenly, without looking at the students, without waiting for questions, he strode from the room. The students buzzed to one another about it, but came to no conclusion. Manfield was a good teacher, and all good teachers, they opined, had their quirks. Manfield returned after 30 minutes, composed, a little pale. The discussion continued with cool deliberation, but it confined itself strictly to mathematics. "Ah," said Twistle suddenly, "here's Horam." Cooper emerged from his reverie, stood up hurriedly, and waited respectfully for an introduction. Twistle said, "My technician, Anders Horam. This is Brinsley Cooper of the 28th. He added to Cooper, "Technician Horam negotiated the quantum change you just witnessed." Cooper's extended hand withdrew involuntarily. Was this the man? It gave him a shivery sensation to see the long, veined hands that had actually done the deed. Surely the man's face was in actuality dour and ugly, and did not simply seem so because of his job. Twistle said, "Come, boy, don't hang back. You're not superstitious about quantum changes, are you?" Cooper said, "No, sir, not at all. I'm very pleased to meet you, sir. Very pleased." He extended his hand once more, anxiously. The technician took it for a moment, regarded him frigidly, and said, "I'm sure you are. Don't overdo it." Cooper felt rebuffed and thought rebelliously, "Well, I don't like him." Twistle rubbed his hands, letting his cigarette dangle from the corner of his mouth. "Is everything set up, Horam?"
"Quite set up, computer."
Twistle was looking at Cooper. His hands rubbed one another nervously, and his eyes were filled with gloating, as though he were saving the climax of a lifetime for just a few more moments. He said to Horam, "This young man has been studying primitive times, Horam, the strange time before eternity. He studied its unchanging reality, its one unalterable course of history, its madness, suffering, poverty, disease, war, and famine that no one can change or improve." Cooper looked at Horam in surprise. The technician's lower lip was bitten raw, and he was trembling. "I know that, computer. There is little time left." Twiffle waved his hand impatiently. "I know the time. Well, youngster, have you any idea of what this is all about?" Cooper's throat was raw with the smoke from Twiffle's cigarettes, and he felt his heart begin to speed its beat. He found the voice to say, steadily enough, "I think so." In the days when he looked forward vaguely to some such scene as this, Cooper used to imagine himself making such a remark and Twiffle being thunderstruck. But he wasn't thunderstruck at all, and Cooper felt an edge of disappointment. Twiffle simply beamed and said, "Tell me." Cooper, fighting anticlimax, said, "I specialized in primitive history, as you say. Instructor Manfield separated me from the others and told me he was acting under orders. My studies were particularly thorough with regard to the 24th century, and it was in the 24th century that Harvey Mallon lived." "Good, good," said Twiffle, his face puckering into that of a benevolent gnome. Cooper went on, gathering courage. "It was astonishing that so little was known about the inventor of time travel. I came across one of your papers in an assignment. It interested me, and I looked up some of your other papers on my own time. It seemed to me your researches could lead to only one conclusion, even though you never stated it explicitly."
"You hear that, Horam?" interrupted Twiffle with delight.
"I hear," said Horam. Cooper said, "It seemed inescapable that Harvey Mallon couldn't possibly have invented the temporal field in the 24th century. Nor could anyone have. The mathematical basis for it didn't exist. The fundamental Lefebvre equations did not exist, nor could they exist until the researches of Jan Verdeyer in the 27th century." Twiffle said, "What if Mallon had stumbled on the temporal field without being aware of the mathematical justification? What if it were simply an empirical discovery?" "But it couldn't be if your analysis of the original engineering specifications of the first temporal field is correct. In 100 ways the Lefebvre equations were used. Coincidence or luck couldn't possibly have accounted for the way in which Mallon designed the machine with perfect economy and rationale."
"Yes, yes."
Cooper's confidence swelled. He said triumphantly, "There was only one way Mallon could have learned of the Lefebvre equations. He was told about it by a man from his future, by someone from eternity. Am I right, sir?"
"Quite right, my boy. I was confident you would work it out for yourself on the basis of what you experienced. If you were the right man, you would have to. It was a necessary test, eh, Horam?"
Horam looked sideways at Twiffle with a flicker of his dark, brooding eyes.
"You are the computer, sir. But what other reason would there be never to have warned him during training of his final mission? Surely there could be no other reason."
"Of course there isn't," snapped Twiffle angrily. He threw down his cigarette, crushing its life out with the sole of his shoe. Humbly, Horam bent, picked it up between two fingers, and dropped it into the stub receptacle. Slowly, over the next few minutes, he dusted those fingers against one another, over and over and over. Cooper noted the byplay, but his mind was not concerned with it. Now that he was finally face to face with it, a sickness washed over him. He knew the sickness by name. It was fear. He said,
"Then it is true. I am to be the one to go to the 24th.
Twiffle said, "You have been trained thoroughly in the cultures of these centuries. You will be able to acclimate yourself, perform your task."
"But if I don't?"
The sudden realization of an unbearable responsibility took the strength from his legs so that he crumpled into a chair.
"If I make a mistake, I'll disturb the creation of the temporal field. I'll make Verdeyer's researches impossible. I'll invalidate the whole basis of the development of etern..."
Twiffle's voice broke in, soft and gentle.
You can't make a mistake, son. There is only one reality in primitive times. You have already been there. You have already done your job. You have already succeeded. You must keep that fully in mind. You are going far downwind to do a job that is already done. Now, I have the engineering specifications of the temporal field here. Cooper looked up. He stared at the small roll of film in its translucent container. He said in shock, "But that's Malin's own set?" Surely it could be no other. He had seen the very object in the Museum of Primitive Art and Science in his own era. The translucent container, rosy in color, with its graven map of a portion of North America. Malin's very set.
"But it can't be. It's his. If I take it to him for him to use, and if he leaves it for us to take and bring to him for him to use..."
Cooper laughed weakly.
"It's a circle. It can't be. Who drew the plans in the first place? Where does it start? It's impossible."
"There are no paradoxes in time, son," said Twiffle. "You'll find that out more and more as you grow older. I, a native of the 1025th century, have ordered quantum changes that may have killed my grandfather as a baby, yet here I am. All apparent paradoxes are the result of time-centered thinking instead of eternity-centered thinking. Times exist all at once, just as space does. It's only our human limitations, even here in eternity, that make us persist in thinking of time as happening in consecutive instants. Suppose Malin's plans do oscillate in time from now to then and back. What of it? A pendulum oscillates in space. What of that?" The computer's hand was resting on his shoulder very softly. Cooper looked up, and the wrinkled face that stared across at him was blurred. The young man blinked his eyes, but the blurring persisted. "It's time to go to the 24th, son," said Twistle. Cooper said,
"I'm ready."
With a weak smile, he added,
"I've got to be ready. I've already been there."
In 2 hours, Cooper learned a great deal. He learned something about eternity's tools. He learned that, in addition to the kettles that moved within eternity, there was something else that could be hurled out of it. It looked like a kettle, but attached to it was a complex mechanism whose bus bars looked capable of handling energy transfer at rates Cooper did not attempt to imagine. Horam bent low over the bones and vitals of it, checking, adjusting, all without a stir of the facial muscles. Cooper learned much about his mission. Twiffle spoke rapidly and not always coherently. Invariably, though, his words returned to the flimsies he held. He said, "You will find yourself in a protected and isolated spot in the year calculated as optimal. Food, water, and the means for shelter and defense will be sent with you. The flimsies will be meaningless to anyone but you. They will give you further instructions in detail. When it is time to return..."
"How long, sir?" asked Cooper.
Twiffle hesitated. "I am not sure. 2 years, 20 years, 2 days?" His tone sharpened. "I tell you, I don't know, youngster. Whenever you're through, whenever you return to the coordinates at which you arrived, you will have a fixed point bar locator as part of your equipment. This kettle will be activated." His old voice went on and on. Horam straightened, placed his right hand upon one of the porcelain dials, and waited. Twiffle's tone increased in urgency. "We cannot attempt to counterfeit their medium of exchange or any of their negotiable scrip. You will have gold in the form of small nuggets." Cooper thought wildly. "Why didn't they tell me all this before? I can't do it. I won't." Cooper learned something about himself. He learned that looking forward to a great romantic feat of danger was not at all the same as finding it in your lap leering at you. He found that he wasn't as old as he thought, not as brave as he thought, not as devotedly idealistic as he thought. And he also found that despite all that, he was going to manage to go through with it. Twiffle was warning him again about the information he must not give and the information he must give, then checking himself to exclaim impatiently that Cooper couldn't do anything wrong, since primitive times were invariant, and he had already done it all right. Cooper scarcely heard him now. He was in the kettle, noting with a slight pricking of interest the economy of space
and the manner in which supplies had been introduced, nevertheless. "Are you ready?" Twistle said finally. He stood there, directly in front of Cooper, legs apart, his cigarette for once held motionless between stained fingers, its smoke rising in slow curls. Cooper thought with a sudden wild surprise, "He's more scared than I am." Oddly, the thought gave him courage. His spirits lifted, and he said, "I'm ready." The last thing he saw, before a strange giddy grayness closed down momentarily upon his vision, was Horam's left hand moving a switch down toward contact, while the fingers of his right hand, at which the technician did not look, gave to the porcelain dial they held a sharp and sudden twist. 7. Senior Computer Twistle could see that his hand was shaking, and that annoyed him. The boy was gone. The deed was done. The manipulation had been perfect. It was over. When he put his hand to his forehead, then, why should both be clammy? Was he a cub computer, fretting and shaking over his first quantum change, or was he Twistle? It was over and done, damn it. He said it aloud, angrily. "It's over." "Yes, Computer Twistle," said Horam. Twistle started. "What?" Somehow he never expected Horam to speak, except in answer to a direct question. When he did speak, Twistle always had that momentary sensation that an extension of himself, an arm, a leg, had suddenly been endowed, like Balaam's ass in the old myth, with miraculous speech. But Horam was doing more than talk. He was smiling. In all their association, Twistle had never seen Horam smile. He stared now at the twisted mouth and bared teeth that bore the aspect of a smile while emitting none of its warmth. He stared at the glee that sparkled in the technician's eyes. He said roughly, for he was very tired, "What's the matter with you, Horam?" Horam said, "It's over. Everything's over. I'm happy." "Good. I'm happy, too. Now, stop leering at me, please. Take a few days off. You've earned them."
"More than you know, computer," said Horam.
His grin remained. Twistle puffed madly at his cigarette, burning it nearly to the skin of his fingers before discarding it. He drew the smoke deep into his lungs and expelled it forcefully through parted lips. "What don't I know, Horam?" He grew angry, for he felt in no mood for foolish talk.
"Why, that everything is over. This, you, I, all eternity."
"What in time are you talking about, man? Do you know?"
"I know."
Horam drew closer. Twistle backed hurriedly. With sudden acute discomfort, he remembered something he did not usually bring to mind. The man had a history of mental difficulties. Twistle had known that when he requested Horam's assignment to himself as personal technician. But then Horam's soulless efficiency and his fanatic devotion to the ideals of eternity had to have a neurotic basis. For his own purposes, Twistle needed just such an iron-bound personality. And certainly in his years with Twistle, Horam had always behaved himself to the computer's complete satisfaction. He was queer enough, and who was not queer, Twistle demanded of himself, and no one would ever think him a lovable character, yet the fact remained that without his complete loyalty, it was doubtful whether the project could have been carried through. But now it was no Horam that Twistle could recognize, moving closer to him and extending a lean hand as though anxious to feel Twistle's flesh, make certain that Twistle was really standing there, that it wasn't all a dream. It was the only way Twistle could account for Horam's expression. The man was so happy he could scarcely believe in the reality of his own happiness. Was it the release of an overtaught nature by the final accomplishment of the long-drawn-out project? "You're overtired, Horam," said Twistle. But Horam only shook his head.
"I want you to understand, computer. Eternity is over. It's done. Do you think eternity can have no end? That it is everlasting? Think again. Eternity may not have an end in time, but it can have one in reality. You see that, don't you? You're a computer. You're very intelligent."
Twistle was beginning to guess. His whole body trembled now. He shouted, "Horam!" Horam's grin disappeared, but the glitter in his eyes remained ferociously joyous. "Yes, Horam.
just an observer and technician, someone for Finge to experiment with. 1,000 realities have come and gone since eternity began. Can you recall all the realities you changed, computer? I can recall one of them. You changed the 482nd 10 physio years ago. You countersigned Finge's analysis. I learned a great deal about that quantum change afterward, but I wonder if you remember. Finge died. Damn him, he died too soon. But you live. You must remember. Twiffle broke into the breathless stream of the other's words. How can I... What was left of the sentence was swept away. Horam cried. How can you remember? There were so many changes that 1 billion lives, more or less, are too puny to clutter your mind. What are the generations of man to a computer who can flick them about with a puff of breath? Do this. It is done. Nothing on earth is left unchanged. Who gave you the right? Who gave you the right? The technician lifted both clenched fists into the air. Twiffle moved toward the door, and Horam brought his arms down, moving quickly to forestall him. You will listen to me, computer. I listened to you for 5 years, and surely you can spare me as many minutes. Did it ever occur to you that a victim of your tamperings might someday wish to return the compliment? Twiffle said huskily, What have you done? Horam said, I've changed reality all by myself. And not only for the poor creatures in time. I've changed it even for us. Think of it. Realize it. Live with it. Soon, tomorrow, next year, maybe next minute, there will be an end of eternity.
There can't be, whispered Twiffle.
There can be. There is, cried Horam. You sent that boy back to the 24th to inspire the invention that led to eternity. What if that invention is not inspired? Will there ever be an eternity? The boy asked where the plans for the temporal field came from. You said they oscillated in time as a pendulum did in space. What if someone cuts the string of the pendulum, eh? What if someone interferes with the temporal oscillations of the precious plans? Again, Twiffle asked,
What have you done?
You can guess, I think. Just as I was closing the switch that sent Cooper back in time, I turned the chrono control. He was not sent to the 24th, but to some time earlier than that. Centuries earlier. I do not know the year. I don't even know the century. I didn't look at the control as I turned it, and I turned it once again before I released it. And that disrupted the automatic feedback of the kettle to the same spot in time if and when Cooper attempts reactivation for a return trip. He's lost, computer. Lost forever in the primitive era. Already the fabric of reality must be stretching with every moment that Cooper is in a century in which he doesn't belong. Sooner or later, the changes he is introducing will reach the quantum level. You and I know all about quantum changes, eh, computer? And all reality will leap its moorings. Only this won't be anything like the quantum changes we've introduced so far. This time everything, even eternity, will be included, because the quantum change will involve the non-invention of the temporal field. And then finally, I'll be quits with you and Finge, and all the rest, and I'll live in the new, unchanging reality, and find Nois again. He flung his arms about wildly, then threw himself to the floor in an agony of laughter that continued hoarsely while his shoulders heaved and quivered. Twiffle stared down at him in a moment of frozen horror. Horam's laughter cracked and faded. He lay still. Twiffle burst out of the laboratory, his high old voice nearly cracking as he shouted, Someone get me Instructor Manfield of the 28th on the Communo. Manfield of the 28th! And an ambulance. Damn you all, move! Manfield! Instructor in the 28th! Get him! 8. General Manfield had once described himself as a pacifist before no less a group than the Personnel Committee of the Alwyn Council. He had stood before them, some 9 physio years earlier, moving about in a nervous, shuffling bear gait, his broad shoulders stooped, his brown hair matted, his heavy face etched with stubborn lines of unhappiness. We fight a war here in eternity, he said in part, while explaining and defending his month-old petition to the committee.
Against what, I'm not exactly sure. Against reality, I suppose, or against the machine-polished concepts we have of what constitutes human misery. Our ends I believe to be good, but our means I know to be ruthless. As a computer, I have been an officer in that war. I should judge, from what I've done so far, that my rank is about that of a major. His slow words rumbled slower still, as his mind rested upon the archaic metaphor he had conjured up, and then moved by easy and automatic stages to the beginnings of a consideration of primitive history, the study of which was his amusement and his escape. He shook himself with a visible gesture and passed his hand through his hair once again. I am temperamentally unsuited to that role. If it is a war we fight, I can participate no more. It is no use to tell me that it is a just war and that it must be fought. I am a pacifist, and I cannot fight. The chairman of the committee asked him what he intended to do. Surely he knew that a discharge from eternity and a return to his original time was impossible. To pension him off at the age of 40 physio years would set a dangerous precedent. Did he wish to withdraw his petition and ask for hospitalization and rehabilitation? Manfield was violent in his objections. He knew full well that a computer of his standing could be subjected to no such program without either, one, his own consent, or, two, the clear and present danger of psychosis. The second was always hard to demonstrate, and the first they would never get. He pointed to his petition and said in part, I am not asking for complete retirement, merely removal from the front lines. Assignment to the 28th century would enable me to pursue my researches in peace, and would place me in a quiet sector where the assaults on reality are neither frequent nor serious. He could not drag himself away from his own metaphor. The chairman of the committee inquired whether he fully realized the value of a computer's training and knowledge, whether he was aware of the loss eternity would sustain if he voluntarily withdrew from computer status, whether he had considered the difficulty involved in finding a replacement. Manfield said, In my present state, I am of no service to you as a computer in any case. However, I would be willing to be an instructor. Surely instructors are as valuable to eternity as any other classification can be, and one of my qualifications would be hard to find. It is doubtful if the committee would have approved even that compromise if Laban Twissell, who was at that time on the committee, and who had until then confined himself to silence and smoking, had not suddenly offered his agreement in forceful terms. At a meeting with Twissell the next day, Manfield, the official notification of transfer of rating and assignment in his wallet, did his best to thank the man. Twissell brushed the matter away. The quick bird-like motions of the hand that held the cigarette, his bald retreating forehead, and his bright intelligent eyes were familiar to Manfield, as they already were to every computer in eternity. Twissell said, I have the germs of a notion, a great one, maybe a ridiculous one. I won't tell you about it, but I would like to have a good, solid fellow such as yourself back in the far downwinds. An instructor, too. It may come to nothing, but still. Manfield did not try to penetrate these remarks. He was anxious only to leave. His kettle was waiting, and he wanted to get as far into the quiet of eternity's beginnings as possible. In that quiet, perhaps, he would forget his own great crime. He was in the kettle, with Twissell shaking his hand one last time and saying, You'll remember, won't you, if I ever need you? I'll remember, he muttered, with just an edge of impatience. I will always be grateful, computer. But he forgot. Not entirely, of course. As the physio years passed, he did not forget that he was once a computer. He did not forget one horrible night, nor the petition he had drawn up the next morning. He did not even forget that Twissell had come to his aid. He did forget, however, Twissell's vague hintings that his reasons for backing Manfield were prompted not by sympathy, but by a highly practical foresight. He forgot, or rather he never thought about, the fact that he had agreed to consider himself under an obligation to Twissell. Even when Twissell sent down the request that he accept into his class one Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, with the further request that the cub be specialized in primitive history, no germ of memory stirred.
It did not occur to Manfield that this was part of what Twissell already had in mind when he helped place Manfield as instructor in the 28th. Manfield was a known expert in primitive history, and he did not consider it strange that a student should be sent to him for training in that discipline. When Cooper left for the 575th, and when, not 12 hours later, the call came from Twissell, he went to the Communo calmly. He even went so far as to protest, in considerable agitation, against Twissell's first demand that he take a kettle immediately for the 575th. He was not a computer, he explained indignantly. He would prefer not to.
Great time, man, Twissell had exclaimed with tight hoarseness. You'd still be a computer if it weren't for myself. I need you now.
And then Manfield remembered.
I'll be there, he said mournfully.
It took more than 15 minutes for Manfield to obtain even the most general notion of what was wrong. At first it seemed to him that Twissell was merely bemoaning the loss of a mentally unstable technician. Manfield had heard of Horam, the so-called Prince of Technicians. Or perhaps his understanding was slow because he was ill at ease in these surroundings. In all the years since he had taken the kettle downwind to the 28th, he had not returned further upwind than the periodic field trip to the 40th had taken him. Now, here he was, deep in 60 millennial eternity, staring at the man who epitomized the role in life he found most revolting and loathsome. Not 5 centuries away. Not 5. He dragged his mind out of the all-too-ready pit of memory and tried to fix it upon what Twissell was saying. The old computer's voice grew steadier, colder, and the true significance of what he was saying began to penetrate. Manfield's eyes narrowed, and his eagerness to return to the womb he had built himself in the 28th lessened as he listened. Finally, he said,
Computer, did the All-Wind Council agree to allow a kettle to be sent past the beginning of...
Twissell slapped his hands together in fierce disgust.
What has that to do with it? We built this kettle, Horam and I, to accomplish a purpose. Unfortunately, Horam's purpose wasn't mine. Unfortunately, I left too much in his hands.
Will you get that look off your face, Manfield? The theory of penetrating past the beginning of eternity is well known. For obvious reasons, it is a restricted matter, but I managed it anyway.
Very well, then, I did not inform the All-Win Council. What meaning has that now?
Manfield said,
Then I should report you.
And what will that accomplish now? Do you understand what I'm saying? We are facing the end of eternity. Yes, the notion was becoming quite clear to Manfield. The end of eternity? An odd notion, almost a pleasant one. Was he and all the Eternals to endure the fate that they had distributed coldly to so many others? Suddenly he wondered, does a shift in reality hurt? Are memories really changed cleanly? Does nothing linger? Would there be no ghost of a vanished eternity in anyone's mind? Faintly he smiled. It was as though he were being offered, finally, an expiation for his crime, and he smiled. Twissell cried out,
Don't sit there grinning, Manfield. Don't you understand what I'm saying?
I understand you, but...
But you're shocked at my having ignored the council. Is that it?
Listen, Manfield, he said violently. I had to work without them. It was my idea, entirely mine. I couldn't wait for their confabulations and delays. As it is, it took me over 10 physio years. I'm 65 now. It may take 10 years, even 15, for Cooper to complete his mission. I want to be alive when he comes back. I want to be able to say that I made Harvey Mallon possible. I, and only I, was the true originator of eternity. I want to say it. I want the Eternals to know it. Then I can die. For all his burning energy, Twissell's body was not to be denied. His hand shook and his pale lips quivered dryly. Manfield thought with shock, He's old. Old. He found pity somehow and said, expecting no reasonable answer,
What do you want of me?
You know Cooper, and you know primitive times. Find him for me. Manfield shook his head.
How can I? Where shall I look? How shall I look?
See here, computer.
Why don't you settle the matter by sending someone else back to the 24th? Surely there are copies of Mallon's plan for a temporal field. Meanwhile, when Cooper realizes he's in the wrong century and can't get back, he will be enough of a computer and enough of an Eternal to realize the dangers of a quantum change and to avoid... Twithel raged.
You are a fool. An idiot. The boy could bring about a quantum change involuntarily without being aware of it. Besides, it is impossible to send anyone else.
Why? Twithel looked at Manfield with tortured eyes.
Because Cooper is no messenger to Mallon. He is Mallon.
What?
Brinsley Sheridan Cooper is Harvey Mallon, the inventor of the temporal field and the father of eternity.
But that's impossible.
You think so? You think so? Your field of specialization is primitive history, and you think so? Why was Mallon's birthday never established? Couldn't that be because he wasn't born in the 24th? Why does no one know the exact date of his death? Why are there no records? Couldn't it be that, having completed his work, he returned to eternity? And don't tell me about paradoxes.
Manfield shook his head. I'm not a child. I don't talk about paradoxes. Did you tell this to Cooper?
I had to tell him something, yes. But I told him as little as possible to the very end. For optimum results, it was necessary to keep his thoughts on the matter as fluid as possible. History in primitive times is fixed. There is only one reality, so he had to follow it freely. If I told him, if he arrived in the 24th with set notions, he might not be able to adapt quickly enough. The plan was to have him search for Mallon and not find him. He would grow panicky and, in desperation, establish himself as Mallon, reveal the plans for the field himself, close the circle. It must take place that way. We can almost deduce it from history. You know the records. Mallon exhibited his machine only with great reluctance and published his papers only after a delay of 2 years. We used to call it the humility of true genius, but it isn't. It's Cooper wondering what to do.
Manfield said, If primitive reality is fixed, this must be part of it. Maybe it isn't Cooper that's Mallon, but Cooper's great-grandchild. Cooper might hand down the plans.
No, no, no! The plan went wrong inside eternity. Horam wasn't in primitive times when he twisted the controls. He was here, in eternity. And here reality can be fluid. Cooper is where he ought not to be. That is definite. And at any time, at any physio time at all, the quantum change may come and all will be ended.
Manfield responded slowly, thoughtfully.
And if so, I wonder if it might not be a good thing, a desirable thing.
Twithel said,
You can't be serious.
No. The whole notion of eternity is based on the assumption that men, ordinary men, can be trusted with the lives and reality of all mankind.
Not men. We only service the computing machines, said Twithel with difficulty.
Is that right? Was it a computing machine that followed a project for over 10 years without the permission, knowledge, or cooperation of the Alwyn Council? Was it a computing machine that twisted the controls of a kettle with the knowledge it would destroy eternity? If men like you and Horam cannot be trusted, computer, what eternal can be? And if no eternal can be trusted, what good is eternity?
Manfield, Manfield, we have no time for cheap philosophy. There are thousands of Eternals who have devoted their lives to eternity without deviation from its ideals. You, for instance. You, yourself.
Manfield shook his head and said,
Not I. I am as criminal as anyone in eternity can be.
Twithel's eyes transfixed him brightly.
In what way? Tell me.
But quickly. And because Manfield could look another Eternal in the face and feel a kinship in wrongdoing, he found he could finally confess his crime. The crime began with a woman, as Horam's had. That was not coincidence. It was almost inevitable. The Eternal who sold the normal satisfactions of family life for a handful of perforations on paper was ripe for infection.
or, like Twistle, he would fall prey to a basic insecurity and respond with small vanities such as the incessantly ostentatious twirling of a cigarette in a smokeless society, or the larger vanity of seeking personal renown at the risk of all eternity. Manfield remembered the woman with pain and love. She was intelligent and kind. If he were a timed man, he would have been proud to have her as his wife. Not all Eternals, who must take their women only as computing permits, were as fortunate as he in that respect. Yet his relations with her were clouded by something he knew, and she, by the very nature of things, did not. In the reality of that physiotime, she was to die young. She was to die, in fact, within a year of the beginning of their relationship. He knew that from the start. When first he felt attracted to her, first as an individual in an observer's report of the 570th, and then driven by curiosity as the result of seeing and speaking to her in the course of an irregular but perfectly legal tour of personal observation, he had life-plotted her. He had not left it to the life-plotting department. He had done it himself, out of a certain shyness. He learned of her coming death, and at first, as he now remembered with shame, that pleased him. It meant that the chances for a quantum change resulting from their relationship could be but slim. He checked, and that was so. He visited her as often as spatio-temporal charting allowed. Her amiability passed the heights of his expectation, and with her he found contentment. The Alwyn Council, having duly passed upon his calculations, was indifferent. So far he had committed no crime. But what began as the satisfaction of an emotional need became something more. Her imminent death stopped being a convenience and became a calamity. Three separate times, a point in physiotime came and passed, during which some simple action of his own would have altered her personal reality. But he knew that no such personally motivated change could possibly be authorized. Her death became his personal responsibility, and he learned the meaning of guilt. That was no crime either, though it was dangerously weak. Twistle said so, letting his cigarette burn, lured slightly from his preoccupation with the overwhelming danger that surrounded him. Manfield shook his head and said softly, "You cannot understand." He took no action when she became pregnant. Her life plot, modified to include her relationship with Manfield, indicated pregnancy to be a high probability consequence. Generally, such an eventuality was avoided, but sometimes timed women were made pregnant by Eternals. It was not unheard of. But because no Eternal might have a child, the pregnancies were ended painlessly and efficiently. There were many methods. Manfield did nothing. She was happy in her pregnancy, and he wanted her to remain so. He knew that she would be dead before the fullness of her term, so he only watched with veiled eyes and smiled painfully when she told him, in triumph, that she could feel life stirring within her. This still was not a willful crime on Manfield's part, but it was ignorance. And ignorance can be almost a crime. For she gave birth prematurely. It was something Manfield had not anticipated. It was an aspect of life of which he had little experience, and the possibility of premature birth had not occurred to him. Yet how had it come about that the life plot he had made did not indicate it? He went back to his life plot and found the living child, in an alternate solution to a low-probability forklift he had overlooked. A professional would not have overlooked it. What could Manfield do now? He could not kill the child. The mother had 2 weeks to live. Let it live till then, he thought. 2 weeks of happiness is not an exorbitant gift to ask. The mother died, as foreseen, and in the manner foreseen. Manfield, for the time permitted by the spatio-temporal chart, sat in her room, aching with a sorrow all the keener for his having waited for it, in full knowledge for over a year. In his arms he held her son and his. Twistle said, with horror in his voice, "You let it live?" "You can't understand," said Manfield.
"But it was a crime."
It was a crime, but it was not the crime. He let it live. He put it in the charge of an appropriate organization and returned when he could, in strict temporal sequence, held even with physiotime, to make necessary payments and to watch the boy grow. 2 years passed. Periodically he checked, making sure the boy's life plot in no way induced quantum changes. It was a good life plot, and Manfield was pleased. The child learned to walk and mispronounce a few words. He was not taught to call Manfield Daddy. Whatever speculations the timed people of the child care institution might make concerning the large man who paid so regularly remained speculations, nothing more. Then, when the 2 years had passed, the necessities of a quantum change that included the 570th at one wing was brought up before the Alwyn Council, and Manfield, lately promoted to associate computer, was placed in charge. The pride of the moment was alloyed with apprehension.
It would have to be, said Twistle. Children are hostages to time.
Manfield shook his head in annoyance at the aphorism. He worked at the quantum change and did a flawless job, but his apprehension grew. He succumbed to a temptation he had known in his heart he would never be able to resist. He held back his solution while he worked out a new life plot for his son. That was a second crime, as great as the first, and still it was not the crime. For 24 hours, without eating or sleeping, he sat in his office, striving with the completed life plot, tearing at it in a despairing attempt to find an error. There was no error. The next day, still holding back his solution to the quantum change, he worked out a spatio-temporal chart and entered time at a point more than 30 years upwind from the birth of his child. That was a third crime, greater than the first two, and still not the crime. His son was 34 years old, as old as Manfield himself was now. He had no knowledge of his father, no memory of a large man who had visited him in his infancy. He was an aeronautical engineer. The 570th was expert in half a dozen varieties of air travel, and Manfield's son was a happy and successful member of his society. He was married to an ardently enamored girl, but would have no children, Manfield knew. At least there was that, said Twistle, and placed his cigarette stub in a disposal unit. I told you I charted his original life plot for quantum change. I am not completely abandoned. Manfield spent the day with his son. He introduced himself in a business connection and spoke to him formally, smiled politely, took his leave coolly. But secretly he watched and absorbed every action, filling himself, living fiercely that one day out of a reality that tomorrow, by physio time, would no longer have existed. He returned to eternity and spent one last horrible night wrestling futilely against what must be. The next morning he handed in his computations and prepared a petition to the Alwyn Council for transfer of classification.
And you helped me, computer, Manfield concluded.
Twistle said, Your son, I suppose, did not live in the new reality.
Oh, he lived, said Manfield slowly. He existed, as a paraplegic from the age of 4. 42 years in bed, under circumstances that barred me even from arranging to have the nerve-regenerating techniques of the 900s applied to his case. I did that to my son. It was my mind and my computing machines that computed that new life for him, and my word that ordered the change. I committed a number of crimes, but that was the crime that finished me as a computer.
9. Twistle blamed himself for his initial panic in proportion as that panic subsided. He had acted quickly enough in sending for Manfield, but then had been thrown off base. First by Manfield's slowness in understanding, and then by the man's neurotic reluctance to help. It was only when Twistle recognized in Manfield's sullenness the turmoil of a private grief and a private guilt that he could seize the initiative once more. This he did by allowing Manfield to talk. He felt the ground go solid beneath him, and he steadied. He did not try to hurry Manfield. He let the minutes pass. By the time Manfield had finished, Twistle was tasting his cigarettes again. He did not rush into speech. Rather, he allowed more minutes to pass while the catharsis of confession emptied Manfield of his congested guilt. As a computer, Twistle had, of course, a working knowledge of psychoengineering. Intellectually, if not emotionally, he could follow in the track of Manfield's mind. What had happened was equivalent to the lancing of a boil. Someday, Twistle thought, psychoengineering ought to be raised to the status of a separate specialty classification in eternity. Finally, he said quietly, If eternity ends, the equivalent of your tragedy will happen to uncounted men and women. You can prevent that. He waited, then went on. You know primitive history. You know what it was like.
It was a reality that blindly flowed along the line of maximum probability. In the centuries of physiotime that eternity has existed, we've lifted our reality to a level of well-being far beyond anything primitive times knew, but also to a level which, but for our interference, would be very low probability indeed. Twiffle watched the silent Manfield narrowly, then said, "With eternity gone, 1,000,000 years of human history will revert to an unchangeable reality of ignorance, slaughter, and misery. Your own experience should give you a better insight into the meaning of that and the necessity of its prevention than I myself can possibly have." Manfield raised his head. "But what can I do?" It was surrender, and Twiffle knew it. He acted at once to bar reconsideration on the other's part, and moved quickly to the controls of the kettle through which Cooper had disappeared past the beginning of eternity. "Come here, Manfield." Twiffle had lost an hour, all told, but with that hour he had bought a chance. He did not let himself think how slim the chance was. He felt excited. At least he was doing something. He said, "This is the chrono control, the rheostat that controls the temporal length of the kettle thrust. If I had added a lock to make certain its setting could not be disturbed once set, but of course I left details like that to Horam." He smiled twistedly. "Now, Horam stood so," he went on. "He turned the control just as he closed the switch. He told me so. And if I can follow the workings of his emotions now, he used his one hand on the chrono control for one spasmodic twist in hate and anger." And as Twiffle said that, his own face seemed to mirror those emotions, and his hand, gripping the porcelain knob, turned it savagely. "What does it read?" he asked breathlessly. Manfield bent close. "Somewhere in the 20th. Let's see. 19... "It's no use reading it too closely," said Twiffle. "It can only be an approximation." He put his cigarette to his mouth, peered through the smoke. "What do you know about the 20th, Manfield?" The instructor shrugged. "You studied it, of course," said Twiffle. "Oh, yes." "All right. Let's imagine ourselves in Cooper's place. He's a bright lad, intelligent, imaginative, wouldn't you say?" "A very capable youngster." "And an eternal. That's the important thing." Twiffle shook his finger. "That's the important thing. He's used to the notion of communication across time. He is not likely to surrender to the thought of being marooned in time. He'll know that we're looking for him."
"Yes, but what can he do about it, computer?"
Twiffle's shrewd old face stared up at Manfield, its lines crinkling. "Is there any particular source you used in studying the 20th? Any documents, archives, films, artifacts, reference works? I mean primary sources, dating from the time itself."
"Naturally."
"And he studied them with you?"
"Yes."
"Then doesn't it follow that he might try to insert into one of those objects, an object he'd know you were accustomed to looking at and studying, some reference to himself?"
"That's far-fetched."
"Maybe," agreed Twiffle quickly. "But what else can he do? If he does nothing, we're done. We're through. It's over. The one chance we have is that he's done something and that we can penetrate his thinking. That's why I need you. First, you know him best. For 5 years you've had him under your continual care. Second, it is you he would automatically try to reach. If he knows and loves anyone in eternity, it would be you. Third, you and only you would know where to look. You and only you would recognize his message." Manfield said with an anxious shake of his head,
"But I don't know where to look."
"Ask yourself, was there any one source which more than any other you consulted with respect to the 20th? Is there some particular form of record that Cooper would associate automatically with the 20th? Think, man. It's our only chance." He waited, his lips pressed thinly together. Manfield said,
"There were the news magazines. They were a phenomenon of the early second millennium. One in particular was very useful. Its first issue dates from 1923. Of course, he might have been sent back earlier than that."
"And he might not.
We've got to start somewhere, Manfield.
It continued well into the 22nd.
Very well. Is there any way, do you suppose, in which he could make use of that news magazine to carry a message? Remember, he'd know you'd be reading it, that you'd be acquainted with it, that you'd know your way about in it.
I don't know. Again, Manfield shook his head. It affected an artificial style. It was selective rather than inclusive. It would be difficult or even impossible to rely on its printing something you would plan to have it print. Even if Cooper, let us say, managed to get a position on its staff, which is very unlikely, he couldn't be certain that his exact wording would pass the various editors. I don't see it, computer.
Twistle said, "For time's sake, think. Concentrate on that news magazine. You're in the 20th, and you're Cooper with his education and background. You taught the boy, Manfield, and you've been a computer with psychoengineering training. What would he do? How would he go about placing something in the magazine, something with the exact wording he wants?"
Manfield's eyes widened.
"An advertisement." "What?"
"An advertisement. A paid notice which they would be compelled to print exactly as requested."
"Ah, yes. They have that sort of thing in the 182nd.
I imagine they have it in a number of eras, but the 20th is absolutely peak in that way. In fact," said Manfield, suddenly warming to his subject, "the 20th is in many ways the peak of primitive time. The cultural milieu..."
"Not now, Manfield. Back to the advertisement. What kind would it be?"
"I haven't the slightest idea, computer."
Twiffle stared at the lighted end of his cigarette as though seeking inspiration. "He can't say anything directly. He can't say, 'Cooper of the 28th calling eternity.'"
"He might."
"He'd be a fool if he did. And I don't think he's a fool. He would be asking for a quantum change."
"More likely arrest for mental observation. In primitive times, any serious implication of time travel was pure insanity."
"All right. In direction. That's what it would have to be. It must seem perfectly normal to the men of the time. Perfectly normal. And yet obvious to us. Very obvious. Obvious at a glance, because it would have to be found among uncounted individual items. How big do you suppose it would have to be, Manfield? Are those advertisements expensive?"
"In the news magazine, I should say, moderately so."
Twistle said, "And ideally, to avoid the wrong kind of attention, it would have to be small anyway. Guess, Manfield. How large?"
Manfield spread his hands.
"Half a column." "All right. Now we have the first approximation. Look for a half-column advertisement which will, practically at a glance, give evidence that the man who put it in came from another time, and yet which is so normal an advertisement that no man of that time would see anything queer in it."
The instructor said, "What if I don't find it?"
"Then we'll think up some alternative for you to investigate. And if that fails, we'll try something else. And then something else. As long as we live, an eternity exists."
Twiffle remembered his panic now only as a bad and unworthy dream. He was doing now. He was acting. His keen mind was thoroughly occupied with the thrill of the chase, and not at all with the consequences of failure. Twiffle stared curiously at the books in Manfield's library. Occasionally, because he could not bear to do nothing, he would take one down from its shelf, peer through its crinkling pages, and silently mouth the archaic words. His knowledge of the three millennial dialect, while not as extensive as he would like to have men believe, was sufficient to enable him to catch phrases and sometimes whole sentences.
"This is the English the linguists are always talking about, isn't it?"
he asked, tapping a page. "English," muttered Manfield. Twiffle had never quite been this far downwind before. All of eternity here seemed to have a musty look, as though it were not really eternity, but merely a somewhat advanced primitive era. It might have been the library itself that gave rise to that sensation. Twiffle was acquainted with several book eras. His own century, to be sure, was a film era, as most eras were. Others were molecular recording eras. Still, books as such, while pleasantly outlandish, were not at all repulsively outmoded. But when they were lined up in such numbers...
Even in those sections of Eternity given over to the book eras, books in the libraries of Eternity were converted to film or to molecular patterns, if only out of consideration for space economy. Twistle glanced across at Manfield. The instructor's large shoulders were hunched over the spotlighted desk. Brown hair, in complete disarray, was all that showed of his head. He cultivates archaism, thought Twistle. He prefers books. He hides in a universe of fixed reality. It's his security. But he was too restless for any one line of thought to linger long. He took another book down from the shelf, opening it at random. What if he just turned a page and there... He blushed inwardly and put the book back. Manfield turned the pages regularly, only one hand moving, the rest of the body fixed at rigid attention. At what seemed eonic intervals, Manfield would rise, grunting for a new volume. On those occasions, there would be the coffee break, or the sandwich break, or the other breaks. Manfield said heavily, "It's useless, you're staying."
"Do I bother you?"
"Of course not."
"Then I'll stay."
And Twistle, feeling cold and alone, resumed his soft, sporadic, and useless assault on the bookshelves, the sparks of his furious cigarette burning his finger ends disregarded. And a physio day ended. Twistle said helplessly,
"There's so much. There must be some faster way."
Manfield said, "Name it. I can't let a single page go by."
"How much have you done?"
9 volumes. 4.5 years. Twistle said,
"He'll have landed on the edge of the North American southwestern desert. That was deliberate, since it's very sparsely populated, even in the 20th, I believe."
Manfield nodded absently and turned another page.
"We intended him to have some time unmolested, in which to adjust himself. He had a good supply of food and water. He would be bound to be cautious. It would be days before he really contacted a settled area and ran much risk of quantum change. We might have weeks."
He wasn't quite sure that he believed himself, but he said it again.
"We might have weeks."
Methodically, Manfield turned another page, and another. "Eventually," he said, "the print starts blurring, and that means it's time for sleep." A second physio day ended. And at 10:22 a.m. on the third physio day, Manfield said, in quiet wonder, "This is it." Twistle didn't absorb the statement. He said,
"What?"
Manfield looked up, his face twisted with astonishment. "You know, I didn't believe it. By time, I never really believed it, even while we were working out all that rigmarole about news magazines and advertisements." Twistle had absorbed it now.
"You found the ad."
He leaped at the volume Manfield was holding, clutching at it with shaking fingers. But Manfield maintained his hold. He put the volume down with a slap and pointed to a small advertisement at the upper left-hand corner. It was simple enough. It read, "All the talk of the market." Underneath, in smaller letters, it said, "Investments Newsletter, P.O. Box 14, Denver, Colorado." Twistle said confusedly,
"Market?"
"The stock market," said Manfield impatiently. "A system by which private capital was invested in business. That's not the point. Don't you see the line drawing against which the advertisement is set?"
"Of course," said Twistle, frowning. "To whom should a drawing of a mushroom cloud be familiar if not to a computer? 3/4 of the quantum changes in Eternity were made necessary by the desire to wipe out the development of fission and fusion bombs without wholly crippling nuclear science."
The computer said,
"It's an A-bomb. Is that all? It has nothing to do with the subject of the advertisement. But surely that incongruity is not what caught your eye."
He was bitterly disappointed.
"It's only an attention-getter."
"Attention-getter? Great time, computer. Look at the date of the magazine issue." He pointed to the top heading. It said March 28, 1932. It was page 30. 1932, said Manfield. "And the first A-bomb explosion took place in July of 1945.
"Are you sure?"
"I know this era. I'm positive.
Until July 1945, no human being who had ever lived had ever seen a full nuclear mushroom cloud. No one could possibly reproduce it so accurately except...
It's just a pattern, said Twistle, trying to retain his equilibrium.
It might resemble the mushroom cloud coincidentally.
Might it? Will you look at the wording again?
Manfield's fingers punched out the short lines.
All the talk of the market.
The initials spell out Adam. Coincidence? Not a chance. Don't you see how it fits your own conditions? It's something that caught my eye instantly. It would have caught any computer's eye, but mine particularly, because I would see at a glance that it was an impossible advertisement for anyone but Cooper to have put in. And at the same time, it would have no meaning except for its face value, absolutely none at all to any man of that time.
It's Cooper, Computer Twistle. He is calling us, and I'm going after him. We have the date. We have the mailing address. And I'm sufficiently well acquainted with the period to handle myself safely in it.
Twistle felt very weak. He leaned gratefully on Manfield's arm as it was extended suddenly toward him.
Careful, Computer.
It's all right, said Twistle. Let's go. 10. The next day's events were most unusual in several respects. No one but Twistle, and Twistle at his most arbitrary, could have so short-circuited channels, so bulled major lines of calculations through computing machines, so ignored the horrified complaints of operators who found their work disrupted. No one but Twistle could have done all this, and no one but Twistle could have had his kettle ready at new adjustments within 24 hours. To top that, Twistle ignored completely Eternity's convention of always allowing for physio time. He said breathlessly to Manfield, already dressed in an appropriate costume for the era he was to visit,
I'm allowing for no physio time lapse. I'm disconnecting the radiochron.
All right, said Manfield calmly. He adjusted the clumsy trousers of his 225th century outfit, one which he had decided was a close enough approach to the 20th century version, close enough at any rate to make unnecessary any time-consuming tailoring job. Twistle went on.
I don't care if it takes you a day, or a month, or 10 years to get him. I don't care how long he's been there. You'll return to the instant you've left, once you activate the temporal field at the far end. I can't wait through physio time, you understand?
Manfield nodded. It meant that if the chase took him the unlikely length of 10 years, he would return to Eternity aged 10 years with respect to the other Eternals. Psychologically, that would be unpleasant. But he nodded. He buttoned the last button and said, I'm ready. So it was that when Twistle, his heart drumming a red tattoo and his clammy hands almost unable to do what was required, finally managed to plunge the lever home, the kettle never moved. Or at least it left, then returned to the same instant so that there was no apparent gap in its existence. In fact, the only change that took place was that in the kettle, immediately next to a suddenly tired-looking Manfield, was a somewhat gaunt but not visibly aged Brinsley Sheridan Cooper. And then Twistle performed in the most unusual fashion. It was quite out of character. Before the amazed eyes of the other two, he burst into sudden and unexpected tears of sheer relief. Cooper remained a little over one physio day in Eternity. Through all those hours, he remained a little hilarious. Never quite himself, it seemed. Never quite getting used to the fact that he was actually back in Eternity.
If you knew, he kept saying, how I felt when I first got hold of a newspaper. I wanted the exact day, you know. Only it turned out to be 1931. I thought I was going mad.
But what made you think of the advertisement, boy? Asked Twistle.
It was magnificent.
I didn't think of it for months. If you'd known the things I tried to do first. I tried to leave stones with carvings, only I didn't know how to carve stone without a McIlvain pierce tube. Then I tried to think up a way of getting into archives. For 2 months I tried to get a job at one of the government printing offices, but there was something called civil service and I didn't have a birth certificate. Besides, there was an economic depression underway. My supply of bullion was sinking.
If you had landed 2 years later, said Manfield dryly, your gold would have done you no good. There was a period where the possession of gold was illegal, he went on to explain to Twistle.
In any case, said Cooper,
Finally, I thought of the news magazine we spent so much time over, Instructor Manfield. At first, I thought I'd put in something in 60 millennial dialect for Computer Twistle, you know. But they wouldn't take an ad they couldn't understand, so I tried again in plain primitive English. I knew Instructor Manfield would understand. Then, the very day it appeared, there was Instructor Manfield's telegram at the post office. Wow! Twistle said, "You'll have to leave Eternity again tomorrow. You understand that, don't you, youngster? There's still a job to do." "That's all right," said Cooper jubilantly. "It's nothing now, after what I've been through. When I found out there wasn't any temporal field to reactivate for the return, I knew there'd been an accident. I felt so lost. In the 24th, at least, I'll know I'm coming back. Great time. I feel so sure of myself now that if I don't find Harvey Mallon right off, I have half a mind to just assume his name and give Earth the temporal field myself. So help me, I will." And over his head, Twistle's eyes met those of Manfield. 11. They sat together, the two of them, alone again. Twistle said wonderingly, "Maybe it was all meant to be after all." Manfield said, "How's that?" "You heard his remark about taking Mallon's place, and you know he will. Now, would he have been willing to do so, would he have had the ability to do so, if he hadn't gone to the 20th first? Would the cycle have been completed?" Manfield thought grimly. He's going to cancel his mistake. He's going to convince himself it wasn't a mistake at all, that it was all just another stroke of Twistle genius. Aloud, he said, "How can we ever tell?"
"I feel it. Even a computer can be intuitive once in a while, I suppose. I am convinced that Cooper belonged in the 20th just as he belonged in the 24th. Primitive reality is immutable."
"You didn't think so a week ago. You said the change had taken place within eternity, not within the primitive era." Twistle waved that away with an angry flip of his hands. Manfield insisted, "And how can we tell, anyway? Suppose Cooper had changed reality. We would change. Our memories would change." Twistle snorted.
"Nothing has changed, I tell you."
"But why not? There was Cooper's first attempt to place an ad in 60 millennial. Wouldn't that strain the fabric of reality? Then there was the ad he did put in. How many other people might have blundered upon it between the 20th and the 24th and wondered what a mushroom cloud was doing in a 1932 news magazine? Suppose they wondered at the initial letters, spelling the English word for atom. Cooper was there for nearly 6 months. I was there for nearly 2 days. In that time..."
"The fact is," said Twistle shrilly, "that no change has taken place. Why do you insist the opposite?"
Manfield's shoulders drooped. He could make no denial to himself. If Twistle's ego was chained to the fact of non-change, his own was as intimately concerned with an insistence on the fact of change. He said, "I was hoping," and stopped.
"Well?"
"I thought there might be some little change, a micro-change, so to speak, that would expand its ripples all along the time stream."
"Quantum changes are big changes," said Twistle.
"Ordinary quantum changes, yes. But who knows the mathematics of reality in the primitive centuries? Without the presence of eternity, it's a different case. Why couldn't there be the possibility of micro-changes?"
Twistle said, "What are you driving at?"
"Why might there not be a new reality in which my son is healthy, or one in which he does not exist? Anything but what is."
Twistle said quickly, "There is no way you can check on that. You must not play with time any longer. Nor will I. Nor will I. We've done enough, both of us."
And for a moment there was a return of horror to his eyes, as though once again he found himself staring into the abyss of the end of all eternity. Manfield whispered, "I'll never look. I don't have the courage for it." Preoccupied, he placed a cigarette in his mouth and lit it, then looked up in surprise at Twistle's sharp cry.
Twistle said, "Get rid of that poisonous trash for time's sake. I can't stand it."
Manfield stubbed out the cigarette hurriedly and raised a pair of mental eyebrows at himself.
He was far gone indeed to have lit a cigarette in the company of Eternity's most notorious anti-tobacco fanatic. Twistle's nose twitched at the lingering acrid vapor in the air, and he said, "Just make up your mind to it, Manfield. There's been no change in Eternity. None at all. Take my word for it." And he stared with detestation at what remained of the cigarette.